Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC. And Safety Insurance, offering auto insurance policies designed to help for when the worst happens. You can ask an independent agent about safety insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, this Saturday, the state's third recreational marijuana shop opens, giving people another reason to visit Salem. But they've got a twist when it comes to crowd control, appointment only. We'll talk to Boston Globe's cannabis reporter Dan Adams about this and more. Then we open the lines and ask you, now that we've seen how the rollout of recreational marijuana is going in other towns, you want one to come to yours? Then at noon, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order.
This Sunday marks the 245th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. We'll talk to Harriet Cross, the British Consul General, about how that changed the world and how the U.S. and U.K. survived the breakup to become allies. Then Paul Revel is here to go over the latest education headlines. We'll ask him why an historic strike by Chicago charter school teachers matters. Will this be an example for other charter schools around the country? All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brady,
oh
I am
God,
Marjorie
she's
Egan.
Back.
I am,
go ahead.
I am.
Go ahead. Sorry.
It's okay. And he's Jim Brady. I'm Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I sound much better.
Now, you were out for 3 days because you allegedly lost your voice.
That's
is that
right.
correct?
That's my story.
And I say
I'm
allegedly.
Sticking to it.
Now, this, you know what it reminds me of? Later in his life, I would call my father when we both lived in New York, but as you know, we didn't have a fabulous relationship. I'd call my father. Here's how he'd answer the phone. Hello? Hello? And because he's worried as a bill collector, and as soon as he heard it was me, he goes, "Hey Jim, how are you? Good." That's how you sounded when I talked to you on the. Hello, Jim.
Really, actually, what I was doing, Jim, is I went to New York City and did a lot of Christmas shopping.
Let me tell you something. A lot of people here think that, but we're thrilled you're back. So we're going into the weeds on recreational marijuana. Join us to lead our recurring conversation about the state's budding recreational marijuana industry. We were dying to meet this guy too. He's Boston Globe's cannabis reporter. Dan Adams. He's also the author of the terrific This Week in Weed. Dan, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I've been listening to you guys forever.
You know, Marjorie wanted this job, by the way. Do you know that?
No, I didn't.
Big time.
I think we lost your application in the shop.
I know. I did. Well, you know, I just want to know before we get to the big issues here. You know, lots of reporters get into the business and they bring down presidents or they.
We had
discover,
Woodward on the other day, Bob Woodward.
That's right. Or they discover some terrible malfeasance and they do the investigative reporting. How'd your parents feel when they found out you were going to be the weed reporter?
Well, I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. We can do investigations about weed. No, my parents wouldn't have been happy if I had been using the stuff when I was a teenager. But they're happy that I have a job at the Globe.
Well, you've been doing a great job at the Globe, and I think it's a really fun beat because this is a really big deal in Massachusetts. So you were there the first day when they opened the new stores, and I'm just wondering what. Who was there? I mean, I saw a picture of a guy that looked like a Rastafarian. I saw a young guy, a lot of young men and women. But older people showed up, too, to wait for 2 hours in the snow and the rain. And
2 hours if they were lucky.
If they were lucky, yeah. So who were these people?
You know, the fun thing about covering marijuana is that the cannabis community is probably the most genuinely diverse group of people that you could possibly imagine. It is literally people of all ages, all races, and they're there for all sorts of different reasons. I met a woman from Connecticut. She was there because under Connecticut's medical marijuana law, the conditions that you have to have to get a medical marijuana card, it's a very restricted list. Her condition didn't qualify. So she's coming up to Massachusetts to get medicine. Other people, of course, are just there because they want to get marijuana. They want to get stoned. But, you know, we often see those images, those stereotypical images, the guy in the weed leaf outfit, the, you know, things like that. But if you actually walked along that line, it just looks like America.
So Salem is number three and opens on Saturday.
That's
and
right.
What I read, I guess, in your piece is they're going to have the 600 people are going to get in, assuming they will show up on Saturday or by appointment only. Is that because of the Lester debacle? I mean, that's a reaction to that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually amazing how all the traffic and issues in Lester, where Cultivate, one of the first two stores to open, is located. It's amazing how the issues there are informing the conversation everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So after the folks in Salem saw what happened in Lester, they called the police chief there and asked for tips about what they could do to avoid the same fate in Salem, which, as you know, is a much more congested place than Leicester, Massachusetts. And so they're going to have this appointment-only system. You've got to go online. You got to book an appointment as if you're going to the doctor, and you get a 15-minute window to go in there and shop.
And it was like a Springsteen concert, right? I mean, the spots disappeared practically the second they did appear online, right?
Yeah, as far as I understand it, they're pretty well booked up at this point.
And sort of like
sorry, Marjorie.
Sort of like the
it's okay because it is a little bit closer, Salem.
It is,
Leicester.
Which is always Sunday. So the person who's running Leicester is like 14 years old or something. The CEO, he's really young, is he not? He's like in his young 20s or something.
I don't know his exact age, but he's a younger guy.
Do you know what's going on in Salem? Oh, this was a medicinal marijuana, medical marijuana place before, right?
So all these places were.
All
yeah.
three have been.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're not talking. You know, the whole rollout, we've had this discussion nonstop, both with Chairman Hoffman, who I think both of us feel is a pretty transparent character. I don't know how you feel about him, the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission. But I have to say, and you weren't around for this, virtually the whole political infrastructure opposed decriminalization 10 years ago, and it passed overwhelmingly. Almost all the political infrastructure, which to me is disgraceful because this is about medicine. This is not about having fun and going wild. Medical marijuana opposed it, overwhelmingly supported. And then same deal, overwhelming opposition. And it was approved. The thing that's so upsetting to me about the rollout is even on medical marijuana, we had this discussion with Governor Baker almost every month he was here. It took 2+ years after the people voted to fully comply with the law. And it seems to me, despite what appear to be really good intentions on the part of Hoffman and the other four members of the Control Commission, this rollout, as compared to the Nevadas and some other places, is like proceeding at a snail's pace. Is that an unfair characterization?
No, it's not unfair to say that it's going slow. And I think that you're pointing out rightfully that the people for a long time have been ahead of the political establishment on this issue. And it is puzzling, to say the least, that more political leaders haven't gotten on board with it. Because when you look at the poll numbers, 94% of Americans support legalizing marijuana for medical purposes. And about 2/3, you know, we're coming up on 70%.
For recreational?
Support of legalizing. That's nationally.
That high, really.
That's nationally.
Yeah.
So one would think that one party or the other would try to capitalize on that. I mean, what other issue polls at 94%? I mean, oxygen, puppies?
So, not to mention, there are tax dollars attached to this. So beyond
sure.
that's where
and,
the public
and, I, and just to be clear, I'm not endorsing any particular policy, but I'm just pointing out there's a disconnect between where the public is at and where the political establishment is at. And you've certainly seen strong political reluctance to have ownership of this issue. That's one reason that the Cannabis Control Commission, I think, is independent. Remember, it was going to originally be under the Treasurer's office,
right? Yeah.
And this way, if anything goes wrong, it doesn't fall on anyone's lap. Now, in terms of the rollout being slow, it would be nice if there was a villain that we could all shake our fist at who was directly and solely responsible for the pace of the rollout, which everyone is very frustrated by, including some of the lawmakers who drafted this law. But it wouldn't be fair to point the finger at any one entity. It's been an accumulation of small problems all along the way, from the legislature delaying it by 6 months and rewriting the law, you know, all the way up until now. Really what's been happening, it's just the intensiveness of the regulations. Dick Evans, who's a longtime legalization advocate and lawyer out in Western Massachusetts, he likes to say that the law here treats marijuana like plutonium. And it kind of does. I mean, and when you look at the list of regulations, it's so onerous. And just to take these applications from these pot companies and put them through the conveyor belt of checking, did they do this, did they do that? It takes a long time. There's so many things that they have to comply with.
That's Dan Adams. He's the Boston Globe marijuana reporter. Can I just stay on this for a minute, Marjorie? I know you're about to. You're going to stay on this whole
rollout?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
okay. Go ahead.
We'll get to Mayor Walsh and accusations that he's been part of the problem in Boston for a second. But before we get there, I do want to mention that the Attorney General, as you pointed out in your story, Dan, put the kibosh on these towns that were trying to stall indefinitely on their moratoriums for pot shops. What happened
even though
there?
She was on the wrong side of this, I should
yes,
say, early
was.
On. And was it Mansfield or wherever it was where she originally agreed to an extension, then she flipped because people
were
going nuts.
The towns that she clamped down were Natick, Plimpton, and Rochester. So what happened?
Right. So under the law, any municipality in Massachusetts can ban marijuana establishments, licensed marijuana companies from coming to town. But there's also this other option that they have to impose a moratorium on them, a temporary freeze. under the law, though, a moratorium has to be a planning period. The town has to be using that time to come up with the zoning rules. Where are these businesses going to be located? How are they going to be regulated locally? If you're just using that time to spin your wheels and just push off the debut of these businesses without availing yourself of the actual formal ban process, which is available to you, that's not legal. And so that's what the attorney general said, is that these particular communities, you know, that she looked at their hearing notices, she looked at what their planning boards have been up to. They hadn't actually been dealing with this. And she said, you can't just kick the can down the road for no reason. You've got to actually be working on the rules to be able to do that.
Can you refresh my recollection on the banning thing? Are there different thresholds? I can't remember if the town voted yes on the initiative or voted no. Is that what it is?
That's right, yeah. If any municipality that voted yes on question four would have to hold a community-wide referendum, a vote where you go to the, you know, the middle school gym and cast a ballot about whether to do a ban. Communities that voted no, the legislative body in that town can vote to impose a ban.
So can we talk about Mayor Walsh? He was a lead, frankly, every month he was here, Margaret, and he debated during the campaign. He was an opponent, a high-profile opponent, needless to say. He was with us, was it last Friday? Two Fridays ago, he was there. And I asked him if he is, essentially, if he's, well, here's what I asked him, and you hear what his response is.
You're not acting as an obstructionist.
Oh, God, no. Can I just say something on that?
Of course, man.
One of the things that I find is going to be difficult for us is that there was a meeting the other day in Hancock Street, and some of the folks in the room were criticizing me, saying I'm trying to jam the marijuana facility down their neighborhood. And the problem we're having, not the problem we're having, but the problem we're going to be faced with is that the voters overwhelmingly voted for this, 70% I think in Boston to 30. There are neighborhood organizations that don't want it in their backyard, but the voters voted for it. So the city is pitted now at some point, going to be pitted towards we're going to be approving these things that neighborhoods might not want in their neighborhood.
So he says he's not an obstructionist. Has he been?
Not in any sort of willful, deliberate way where you could point to a particular thing that he did and say the only purpose of this action was to stop these things from opening. Mm. It is interesting to hear him characterize support for this in the city that way, though. Boston voted overwhelmingly for legalization.
Well, he said 70%. He did say it.
Right. Yeah. That's true. But, you know, it is interesting to look at the people who show up to these community meetings, I think you both know, are a very particular breed, right? And they may not necessarily be representative of where the rest of the city's at on this. I mean, really what's happened in Boston has been they're now talking about sort of pausing this process and rebooting it with a greater focus on equity, on locally owned businesses, on businesses owned by people of color and other communities that were disproportionately hurt by the war on drugs.
Didn't John Barrow say one-to-one? Didn't he say at a public hearing the other day he wanted a one-to-one ratio?
Consider.
Like
explain
what
that
is.
Yeah.
Done.
Explain what a one-to-one ratio means.
The idea would be to, and they haven't defined exactly what would be on either side of this ratio, but in general, the idea would be large established businesses would get one license, and then a economic empowerment or equity applicant or somebody from a community that had a higher rates of drug arrests when marijuana was illegal, folks coming from that world would get a license, and each group would move in proportion to the other.
Well, you know, you point out in your story that of more than 50 companies that started Boston's four-stage licensing process, just one of these so-called economic development, empowerment rather, applicant, made it to the second step. And you can't help thinking if you're some mom-and-pop person who has been hurt by incarceration or your family, whatever, marijuana, and you don't have a ton of money, it's not clear to me how you're ever going to get anywhere with all these rules and regulations and the upfront costs.
Sure. I mean, as the lawyers like to say, this is a capital-intensive business, and it's incredibly expensive to start a company that actually complies with that laundry list of rules that we talked about. And look, it's kind of gross. I mean, when you look at the history of, you know, the enforcement of drug laws, it's very crystal clear. Blacks and whites use marijuana at roughly the same rates. Blacks were incarcerated at far higher rates. And there's this big effort in state law now to have people from those communities included meaningfully in this industry, not just as the straw CEOs of companies owned by venture capitalists, but to actually have equity in them.
I'm
not talking
CEO
about anyone. But just to keep that money in those communities. That's the idea. And Boston, I should say, is not alone in struggling to include those people. That's not something I would lay at the feet of the mayor. That's just a reality of those who already have wealth find it easier to raise money.
Well, you know, Dan, you said a while ago you didn't want to lay blame about the rollout on anybody or anybody in particular. I will lay blame, in my opinion at least, and you'll correct me if you think I'm unfair, on the Cannabis Control Commission around this equity thing. You know, Shailene Title, who's one of the, and you did an interview with her, I had her on a couple nights after on TV, frankly, because of the piece you wrote about her advocacy as an individual for legalizing all drugs, which we talk about a lot on the show, a la Portugal. She was the author of all this equity stuff in this bill. And we had this discussion with Chairman Hoffman. Forget full-blown recreational facilities. Everybody knew that things like delivery services and pot cafes were less capital intensive, to use your language of a couple of minutes ago. And rather than putting them on the same front burner that these pot shops are, which are much more expensive to open up, they backburnered them. And so essentially they made a conscious decision. They say it's because they wanted to get it right and, you know, do things deliberately. They made a conscious decision to backburner those entry points, which were much more accessible to people with less capital, people of color, and all those sort of things. Is that not a fair analysis?
Roughly, yeah. I mean, look, a social consumption business or a pot cafe, as you call it, it's not going to be cheap to open necessarily.
How about a delivery service?
But a delivery service, absolutely, yeah. I'm just thinking of the ventilation requirements if you're going to be smoking inside. And it's an open
question
whether
they would allow that. Okay, so why did they do the delivery service
things? Well, look, they were under very heavy political pressure from the Baker administration and others to – In their words, do the basics first. Just get the basic retail stores and the companies that supply them open. And in Governor Baker's words, let's crawl before we walk. Mm-hmm. But it is true that the delay of issuing those licenses is almost certainly going to have a negative impact on inclusion and equity in the industry. And look, those types of
businesses... When are they going to happen, by the way? When are they talking about doing that? Do you know?
It's not clear yet. Right now, they're talking about having a pilot group of cities and towns get together and talk about what the regulations would look like around pot cafes. The other problem with pot cafes is the opt-in process. They're banned by default at the local level. Towns have to vote to say, we want these in our community. But the Secretary of State, Bill Galvin, has said that the way the law is written, that referendum process is unworkable, that the law is improperly drafted, and that there's no way for communities to move forward with that. The lawmakers who wrote the law say Galvin could create such a process under his own authority if he wanted to, and he just doesn't want to have his fingerprints on the marijuana issue.
Well, if Jim asked this, I'm not sure he did, so I want to make sure. What do you think of Somerville's, like, one you know, big company versus one pop and mom and pop kind of thing? Is that possible or is that feasible?
It's hard to say. We'll have to see. I mean, certainly, you know, advocates are applauding the attempt because, again, we talked about just the appearance, just on the surface of it, the lack of diversity and equity among the owners of these facilities, given the history of enforcement here, it's very poignant. And so, you know, kudos to Somerville for trying to solve that problem. The question is whether the equity and the economic empowerment applicants will be able to raise money to open those facilities. And look, the city might face heavy pressure from those established operators. They can't open until one of these other companies opens. So they're going to be staring at their watches saying, you know,
yeah,
let's go.
You know, I had a chance when I was doing a story for the Globe, actually, about legalization to visit the Brookline Medical Facility. And my goodness, you know, it's you can tell that this is a big money operation with a lot of resources. The place is absolutely gorgeous. And
but it doesn't have to be absolutely.
Well,
when I was in Nevada at a place, it was about as bare bones as you can possibly get, other than, I assume, investing in the product, as they call it.
But my point is, it just seems pretty clear to me that what's going to end up happening here is the poor communities, the ones that did suffer from incarceration, I think they're going to get the shaft. I mean, it just doesn't – I don't see where it's not going to happen.
Well, the big problem here is federal prohibition. If banks could give a small business loan to one of these companies the same way that they give a small business loan to any other, you know, retail operation, this would be a lot of, you know, this would be a much easier problem to solve. But banks right now barely want to open a checking account for these folks, much less give them a loan.
You know, on that note, we actually, one of our chief sponsors, and actually they're very good friends of ours, the Sloan family, who owns Century Bank, were the only bank, I think, that agreed to do medical marijuana. In my understanding, is there a credit union or something that is agreed to do?
That's right. The GFA credit union in Gardner, Massachusetts.
So, and they're going to be able to handle hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars? And I mean,
they're not going to be able to service the whole industry alone. They're just not that big a company.
And is the concern, I guess this may be, I mean, is this because they are worried, even with Jeff Sessions going, that Andrew Lell, if a bank decides to process these things, that the U.S. attorney, Andrew Lelling, is going to prosecute them? Is that the fear?
I don't know that there's a fear of, you know, sort of the federal stormtroopers coming in necessarily. But I think it's very expensive to do this type of banking. The compliance requirements are insane. Every time a penny comes in or out of one of these marijuana accounts, they have to file a so-called suspicious activity report with the federal government.
Oh my gosh. You've
got to have a room full of people sort of generating paperwork just for every routine transaction that at another business, a non-marijuana business, would go unnoticed, basically.
Okay, so a couple of things, Dan Adams, that are sort of collateral issues, but hugely important issues. Many of the people who had problems with marijuana, either legitimate or the ballot question, either hid behind or legitimately were worried about operating vehicles under, because there's no chemical test. Your former Emerson classmate, Tori Bedford, who is now part of our team here, wrote a piece for GBH either yesterday or the day before about these drug recognition experts that are being trained by, I guess, by the state or cities and towns. How are police dealing with this? Because as I assume most people listening know, this is not like alcohol where you take, you know, blow in a breathalyzer or whatever. They have to be able to gauge what they're calling impairment to be able to stop somebody, right? Or do something to somebody.
Right. There's no breathalyzer for marijuana.
Yeah.
There are tests for marijuana, but all a test for marijuana can show is whether you've used that drug in recent weeks or even months.
Because it stays in your system.
It can stay in your system, yeah. And it doesn't necessarily tell you how impaired that person is at that moment. The other problem is, frankly, the relationship between how much marijuana somebody has consumed and how subjectively impaired they are is not as linear as it is with alcohol, right? So if someone tells you how many drinks they've had and you know roughly, you know, how big a person they are, most of us can ballpark, you know, how drunk that means that they are. And with marijuana, it just doesn't work like that. People who are frequent consumers could have, you know, an amount of marijuana that would put you or I on the floor, but to them is they call that Tuesday, you know, and so so police are really struggling to get their hands around this, and they're being trained, like you said, as these experts to try to, you know, take an overall look at someone's behavior and try to gauge whether they're impaired. One thing I would say, though, is that we should be clear-eyed about the data on this. When you look at how bad is it actually to drive stoned, it's not good, of course, and driving sober is always preferable, and everyone should, but compared to driving drunk, I mean, driving under the influence of marijuana, when you look at the science, it's more like when being distracted by a cell phone. It's just not on the same
level. No, it's not the same level.
Marjorie thinks if you're stoned, and by the way, we do call her Tuesday. That's her middle name, I should say, that you drive like 12 miles an hour. Well, there's a related. Did you write the original Bernadette Coughlin piece? Was that you? Or Bernadette Coughlin was this woman that I interviewed. I know Nestor Ramos wrote one piece about it, too.
Yeah, he wrote about it.
This is this woman who had used marijuana. I hope I get the story right, but I'm sure you'll know if I get any piece wrong, but most of it is right. Does she fall down at work or something and injures herself, and they do a drug test, they discover marijuana in her system, even though it is, I think, overwhelmingly clear that she hadn't recently used it and it wasn't the cause of the fall. They fire her because they find marijuana in her system.
And they denied her workers' compensation.
Exactly. And she was on my show, television show, same night as Hoffman was, and they actually talked in the green room. They met subsequently because he has great empathy for this. But is anybody – we talked to the Attorney General about it, Maura Healey. What guidance do you give to employers, to employees? Is the legislature – I know they're on a five-month recess, which I mention every single day, but putting that aside for a second, is anybody on Beacon Hill attempting to address this whole issue about what happens if you consume a legal product? It's even worse than alcohol in many ways. I mean, worse for the user. You consume a legal product. You could have consumed, as you said, 3 weeks before. It's in your system if you're drug tested at work, and you can get fired. Even though it had no impact on what you're doing at work. Is anybody on Beacon Hill looking at this issue?
There's been discussions, but is anything like actively pending? No, not necessarily. And it is a huge issue. I mean, the companies in the state can drug test workers and fire them for, like you said, for using a legal substance. You know, a lot of companies, I think, restrict that kind of drug testing to roles, you know, positions that actually involve moving heavy machinery around or doing something where, you know, there's a direct nexus between drug use and their actual job duties. But for folks who are sitting at a desk, it's hard to understand why companies at this point in Massachusetts would be testing for that. But nonetheless, they have the right to.
Now, Dan, before you go, let's get back to some fun stuff. We all heard about edibles, you know, but what are cubes, please?
Cubes.
Cubes.
I'm not actually sure I know. I think I've seen them. These are almost, they look like sort of little gelatins. Is that what you're talking about?
I saw it in a story.
They're sort of a THC-infused little gelatin cube.
Cube, like a little Jello pop.
That's
what do you call those things you do with the liquor? You put the vodka in the Jello.
Jello shots.
I wouldn't know.
Jello shots.
Well, obviously he would.
Didn't you go to college, Jim?
I did go to college. It was a long time ago. So on a much more serious and important note before you leave, if I were Brian McGrory and I was hiring for this position, I would hire someone who had a lot of experience. Now, my understanding is there are two candidates for this job, you and Marjorie Egan. And I don't want to put you in an odd position. I think it's fairly, I don't know you that well. I've known you for like 10 minutes. It's clear that Marjorie had much more experience with the issue than you probably have.
Baby boomers, you know, we started young.
Excuse me, I'm talking to Dan. Thank you, though.
Wild and crazy 70s.
Jim, I feel like you're about to get me in trouble with my mom.
Why did you get this beat and Marjorie came in a distant second, apparently? Do you have any idea, any insight information?
No one returned my phone calls even.
I didn't have the opportunity to review her application, so. But
I had you.
You know what? I guess I didn't know what cubes were, and that was the problem. I thought, what are you going to do?
She dropped the bong during the interview.
I had
experience covering alcohol, which is another regulated industry. And I did have a personal interest in this subject. And look, frankly, a lot of the mainstream media stinks at covering marijuana. And everything because everything they do is punny, right?
Oh.
And they say...
I just did it, by the way, in the introduction.
Thank you very much. Sorry to call you out, Jim. It's fine. No, look, in small doses, it's fine. But I remember back when sales started in Colorado in early 2015. And every TV station had the same scroll across the bottom. It said, Denver, the mile high city. And I just remember thinking, watching that coverage and thinking how dumb it was. Here's this huge new industry, all the social and racial justice issues, the tax revenue that this is going to generate, the jobs, the science, the health, the medicine. There's so much serious stuff, things of substance to talk about here. And so much of the coverage has almost sort of that mocking sing-song tone to it. And that's something that we're trying to change at the Globe.
Well, one last thing as we get to go, but I remember reading a story at least 10 years ago in the New York Times talking about people in their 60s and 70s who had been smoking weed since they were 17 and, still smoking weed and how, they weren't getting stoned every day, but they were, on Saturday night watching a movie, instead of having a beer, they'd have marijuana. And how the point was they'd all held jobs, become taxpayers, bought their houses, had responsible lives, and all this kind of stuff. The idea that this was some crazy...
Well, it's like Reefer Madness.
Exactly. That's how politicians betrayed it, even as recently as 5 years ago in Boston, Reefer Madness. So you could tell that the tide was turning, I think. At least I thought it was then.
Before you leave, This Week in Weed, which I subscribe to, which is great. It's free, right?
It is free.
And so where do they go to do that?
If they go to bostonglobe.com/TWIW, they can sign up for that newsletter. It comes out Saturday morning. It's totally free.
Would you call that a little pun, or is that not a pun?
This Week in Weed?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
Let's just say it's cheeky.
Okay. Dan Adams, thank you very much.
Dan Adams is a
cannabis reporter for the Boston Globe and author of This Week in Weed. Dan, thank you for coming in. Up next, we're going to open the lines and ask you, do you want a recreational marijuana shop to be the new kid on your block or not? You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie's voice has made it through 28 minutes so far. Let me hear how you sound, please, quickly.
Hello, my name is Marjorie Egan.
That's good. That's good enough. Now, if you're just tuning in, we were talking to Boston Globe's cannabis reporter, Dan Adams, with a status report on how the recreational marijuana shops in Leicester and Northampton are doing and a preview of what's to come for the residents of Salem when they open their doors, I think, on Saturday. Well, taking your calls now, asking you, now that this is a reality and the state continues to approve more licenses, are you ready to have a recreational marijuana shop come to your city or town, or are you afraid that your neighborhood will, I shouldn't do this in light of Dan's criticism of stupid puns, go to pot? We've heard the horror stories about what's happening in Leicester as the hordes of shoppers swarm the town, creating traffic jams, blocking streets, peeing in the lawns. In Salem, as we discussed, they're taking measures to make sure none of this happens, or it's unlikely anyway, until the supply and demand in the state stabilizes. You can buy recreational marijuana in Salem by appointment only, and to control traffic, they're urging people to use public transportation, which they'll supplement with free shuttle buses. So will you be going to a community meeting soon to protest these shops or to support them and the up to 3% local tax revenue they will bring to your community. And if you live in Salem, Leicester, or Northampton, we'd love to hear from you, particularly if you have voters' remorse. 877-301-8970. I have to say, I do not get this. It is reefer madness kind of stuff. I understand the traffic thing, but as I said 30 seconds ago, it's purely a function of the fact there are three shops. Soon they're going to be 30, then they're going to be 100. They're going to be like liquor stores all over the state. The only reason Leicester has gone through a terror deal, which is horrible, and I would hate it if I was there too, is because it was one of the first two shops to open.
That's right.
It'll be
people
a little...
were held hostage in their homes.
No, they really were. I mean, it's horrible. But ultimately, when there are as many as there should be, and as the voters intended, even if the legislature doesn't like it, that's going to be gone. Is there a city or town that doesn't need tax revenue? The city or town can levy up to a 3% tax, and what a lot of them are doing, a lot of people think illegally, but they contend otherwise, is extorting additional, and I do mean extorting additional commitments out of the pot shops that are opening there. So it means a lot of money to towns, many of which, I mean, for example,
to Leicester, which is a little town, because they've been one of the first. I mean, they can do a lot with all those hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wait a second, wasn't it Brockton that, I think it was Brockton, and if not, someone will correct me, maybe you, one of the cities that is contemplating doing a lawsuit, which we'll probably discuss with Paul Revel this afternoon, the former Secretary of Education, over the funding formula, is saying that one of the interim things he hopes to do, the mayor hopes to do, is to use money from recreational marijuana. They don't have any shops yet, but once they do, to help close the education disparity gap. I mean, it's pathetic that that's what you got to resort to, because the state should be doing a far more central kind of job. But the money matters. And again, it is, I think the ballot question was something like, the title of it was something like, to legalize marijuana just like alcohol is. And it is essentially, I would argue, alcohol, but not as dangerous. But we want to know what you think. If you're in a community that's going to have a vote, how are you going to vote? How would you like your elected officials to vote if it's going to be decided by your local elected body?
You know, Paul sent me a bunch of informational emails, including telling me that cubes, showing me a picture of cubes.
Oh, the thing you asked
them
about?
Different colored.
What are they?
Edibles. They look like different colored edibles to me. But he makes a great point. He says, so a bar where people have various degrees of personality change from alcohol, which could be quite negative, is fine. I don't recall ever meeting anyone who became a bigger jerk when stoned. Most become more chill. And, you know, that is one of the great points about alcohol. When you look at a lot of violent crimes, they're linked to alcohol. Battering of wives is linked to alcohol. A lot of crimes are linked with alcohol. Needless to say, violence is linked to alcohol. So, and as Dan Adams just said, the people obviously should not be driving when they've been taking drugs. But the impact of marijuana is far lesser, at least as far as we know at this point, than the impact of alcohol.
Why are politicians, with some few exceptions, so afraid to state what is
totally true? That you just, I think it is a lot of ignorance.
Excuse me. We have some of the leaders who voted against this and led the charge, from Maura Healey to Charlie Baker to Marty Wall. They're really smart people. They know what the truth is. Why do they not acknowledge it? They can still be against it if they want. That's fine. I mean, they have to implement the law now. But I mean, during the campaign. But why didn't – is there any sane person that thinks the impact – we shouldn't have to re-argue this argument – that the impact of marijuana use is anywhere near as dangerous in any fashion as alcohol use? I would hope not.
There are people, because we get emails from them all the time thinking this is the road to ruin, and what about the children? And the adjunct to that, obviously, is that the children are already able to get as much marijuana as they want right now in their junior high schools or their middle schools or their high schools. And at least the marijuana that you're going to get at one of these stores is going to be regulated. So it's
and they're not
going
to be able to buy it at the stores. It may be more available to a 21-year-old who gives it to them.
Can't even go in.
Right.
And as
Paul
also mentioned,
unlike a liquor store.
You can take a million kids in with you to the liquor store.
That's exactly right. Okay, 877-301-8970. It's your turn. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's start with Wayne in Providence. Hi, Wayne.
Wayne. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Great.
First time call. Love your show.
Thank you.
As far as this goes, what I don't understand is when the referendum is put up statewide and it gets approval, how can cities and towns then try to set up barriers because the vote didn't go the way they want?
Because I don't know what the provision was in the law, but after it passed, the legislature passed some rules about expanding, I think. I hope I get this right. But essentially, it's part of the law, whether it was in the ballot question or added by the legislature later, that gives some local control. And the good thing, I have to say, is what Dan mentioned a few minutes ago. If you if voters in your community, like Boston, 70% voted for it, the only way you can ban a pot shop is if the voters themselves choose to say, I like it statewide, but I don't like it in my community. Only if your community voted no can your elected officials make the decision. It's basically local control, Wayne. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Because I live next door to Seekonk, Mass.
Yeah.
And they tried to have a ballot question on an ordinance to ban a recreational marijuana store.
What happened?
And it failed.
Mm. Good.
And so they did it again. And it failed the second time. So I think that, you know, if you have a referendum or a vote and it doesn't go the way you want, well, that's kind of tough.
I, you know, by the way, I am so with you, and I am so totally with you, but I think the point that Marjorie and I have been making for years and that Dan Adams confirmed is our elected officials are way behind where the public is, the voters are, on these issues. Wayne, by the way, Wayne, are you anywhere near having this issue come to a head in Rhode Island? I don't even know what the state of affairs is. Are you?
No, we're not. It's medical marijuana is good, but we haven't crossed out of the bridge yet.
Okay, Wayne. I'm sorry.
I think it's much more helpful to, you know, put your efforts into dealing with it responsibly and safely, and just, you know, let the chips get on. I mean, it's the same argument with temperance in the 1920s.
Listen, you're preaching to the choir here. We agree with you completely. Wayne, thank you much for your first call. Do it again soon.
You know, here's a letter from Catherine who says she just attended her first town meeting in Brewster. Never seen such a crowd in all my years.
On this issue?
And she's been to a lot of town meetings.
Wow.
She said the reason for the crowd was marijuana, and she was there to vote to protect the sale, even though she's never smoked it herself. But she said, it almost changed my mind listening to all the people against it. They had no facts, just emotions, and they were scaring me. Until the people with the facts got up, I realized it was like listening to Donald Trump. She said he scares a lot of people without any facts. But I think
there is a
lot of ignorance. I think there's this idea that people are a bunch of, you know, lackluster stoners who kind of go around going, oh, wow, listen to the music, and can't function in
life.
But
that's not true. Did you hear what Dan said? We knew this. I didn't know the number was that high. Close to two-thirds of America, not just New York and Boston and San Francisco, two-thirds of this country supports recreational marijuana legalization. Two-thirds.
Yeah, but obviously there's a lot of people who think it's terrible. They tend to be older people who don't know very much about it. And I think for politicians, the war on drugs has been such a staple. We've been so busy stamping out drugs. Of course, we've stamped out nothing, and we keep paying for it. It's like the definition of mental illness when you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and expect a different change.
Different result,
that's right. It's the same thing with this ridiculous war on drugs. You said before, I think we'd be better off legalizing everything and put the money into treatment instead of with serious drugs. And I've said this a million times, but you know that if opioids were legal to get in a store as opposed to having to get a prescription from a doctor, nobody would be getting fentanyl and they wouldn't be dying from it.
Kevin in Pembroke, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hey, I get medical marijuana, which is a sham actually, right?
Why?
And the reason why I say it's a sham is they give you a prescription for medical marijuana, but they don't give any instructions. But you pay the $200, and if you're on Social Security, you can pay $150, and they will bring it right to your door. What they're standing in line for right now for that quarter ounce, I can get 16 of those brought to my door tomorrow morning.
Are you a legitimate? Did you legitimately obtain a medical marijuana license?
Yes, I did. And on that note, too, when I went in there, right, I have, like, pre-glaucoma.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, I was still smoking it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went in there, right, and I was telling the doctor says, well, what do you do for your pre-glaucoma? I said, I take eye drops, you know, the supplements and everything. And he literally said to me, well, you're the first effing legitimate patient I had in my entire life. That's what he said to me.
That's a good one, Kevin. Thank you for the call.
Well,
we appreciate it.
I think we can rest assured there have been a lot of fraudulent claims of medical need for marijuana. But, you know, it's in part a reaction to our ridiculous
laws.
Hysteria over marijuana. Anyway, we're talking about whether or not you'd like to have a pot shop down the street from you in your town. The number is 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Marjorie is back. We're all excited about that. By the way, Jared was terrific.
You guys sounded great, actually. I listened to you yesterday.
Very short notice.
I said to myself, you know, this radio show's not bad.
Isn't that horrible, by the way? Isn't there, you know, one of the things when you have a day off, I'll tell you an inside secret that probably doesn't surprise anybody. You want the show to be good, but not too good.
Exactly.
You know, is that not?
That's right. That's what I tell Jared. You were great, but don't get any ideas.
So if you're just tuning in, even if you're not just tuning in, we're talking about recreational marijuana shops, asking you if you want one to come to your neighborhood or not. A lot of communities, as we discussed with Dan Adams, are attempting to get these moratoria in place. And to the credit of Maura Healey, she's now denying some of them if it's nothing more than a stalling tactic. Now that we've been able to give recreational marijuana shops a test drive, two of them open in Leicester and Northampton. Salem opens on Saturday. Are you going to roll out the welcome mat in your community, at least do you want your community to, or send the pot industry packing? And if so, why? 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Mike in Fall River. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Great.
Great. I got a few things, if I could, real quick.
Sure.
One, I think the regulations and all that are insane. I really do think it's ridiculous. Because one, I mean, there's been more people that have died from drinking water than have died from cannabis. There's been zero reported deaths. So I think it's just a waste of taxpayers' money. I think it's a waste of time. There's people dying from opiate overdoses. I could go on for days. I'd love to get on your show to debate about it with anyone else. But anyway, so that's one. I think it's just completely ridiculous that we have to go through all these regulations. Two, when it comes to, like, worrying about children getting their hands on gummies, I think there has been way more children getting high at the dentist office than there ever has been children getting a hold of their parents' gummies. So I don't think that's really a huge issue.
Well, can we stay on that for just 1 second? Marjorie's point to me is the most important point. For those who raise that issue, they're in total denial. They act as if no one under 21 is using it now, and the floodgates are going to open, even though it's still prohibited under 21, when the reality is they're using it now and it's a crapshoot because you don't know how safe it is. And while you're anti-regulation, I have to say I like the public. I like the fact that these testing labs do what they do so that you know what you're buying. So this whole argument about kids, as far as I'm concerned, even if it's well-intended, is way off base.
Your marijuana gummies sitting around the coffee table, just like you shouldn't leave a glass full of vodka.
Exactly.
Like water sitting
Exactly.
Go ahead, Mike.
And if your kid gets a gummy, you'll probably figure it out if it works for something. I mean, who knows? Maybe your kid's got a little ADHD or something and takes a gummy. He's like, whoa, this kid's chill now. And it's not going to hurt him. I don't care what anyone says. It is not. We lost my mom passed away because of the stigma behind cannabis, because when she was on medical cannabis, the cancer was shrinking. And there was a whole issue with the family. She decided to stop taking it. She got on hospice care. She died 3 weeks later. So it's just insane that we have to go through this. Like I said, I could go on for days. And I was very disappointed because I started a CBD oil company. I wanted to get on WGBH, but they said they wouldn't because it's a CBD oil company. And even that is even more ridiculous.
I'm sorry, I missed. What would you?
You were trying to advertise? What were you trying to do? Advertise the CBD oil company? I missed it, Mike.
Yeah, with you. I was hoping to get on your show, actually, and we were doing everything we could, but they said that they wouldn't because of CBD.
Send us an email at bprwgbh.org and say to Jim and Marjorie's attention. We'll take a look. Mike, thanks for a fine call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You seem transfixed by the email. Are you or are you not?
No, there were a couple of people that said that somebody just said she was concerned about the link that they found between people who tend towards schizophrenia and marijuana is not great for them. I mean, marijuana is not a cure-all, and it's not to say it's not going to have any bad effects for some people. But again,
they're so negligible.
Ice cream is very bad. You eat too much ice cream, you're going to get high cholesterol. It's going to be a very big problem.
You know, by the way, on the medical marijuana front, when that caller just now told that sad story about his mother, a guy who did a 180, who I think should have been ashamed of himself early on. What's the medical reporter for CNN? What's his name?
Oh, Sanjay Gupta.
Sanjay Gupta originally had a problem. And I, for a guy who is really smart and fact-based, I thought it was embarrassing at the time. But to atone for his sins, he's done at least two follow-ups where he's done fabulous stories about how medical marijuana not only changed lives, but saved lives, including some people having to move from one state to another because they're, the only thing that helped their kid was right. medical marijuana. And obviously what mattered more than where they lived was the health of their child. You should just check them out. They're wonderful documentaries.
We're having a fight among our Brewster listeners.
We are? What are
yeah,
they saying?
Bobby just emailed and said the previous person that was talking about everybody worked up about marijuana was wrong. The only issue was traffic.
Oof. So, Joanne, oh, look where Joanne's calling from. Salem, which opens on Saturday. Hi there, Joanne. How are you feeling about that?
Hey, I'm fine with it. I'm happy that the city's going to take in the tax revenue.
Good.
But what I was calling to say is that Salem's kind of making a festival of it. My ward counselor is going to be making the official first sale.
Oh, I read about that person, yeah. But by the way, the mayor has gone out of her way. We're fans of Kim Driscoll here. She's pretty
mayor.
She's gone out of her way to say she will not be purchasing anything from that store. But go ahead, Joanne.
Yeah, and a number of the businesses and restaurants and whatnot downtown are offering discounts if you have a receipt from the shop.
Really?
So I think it's going to be kind of fun. Yeah. And some lady upstairs from the shop is apparently making decorative stash jars and cans and whatnot. So
it's a big deal.
Fun.
I mean, it's a big deal. It's going to raise a lot of money for your community, which is we love Salem anyway. People want it, and I'm glad they're getting it. So call us next week and let us know how Saturday goes in your city there, Joanne. Thanks so much for the call.
Let's go to
Should actually reach out to Kim Driscoll, you guys, for Monday or Tuesday, the mayor of Salem, to see what how the first weekend went up there. Because obviously, as you said, Saturday at least, and I assume for the foreseeable future, is by appointment only. Because they're trying to avoid the traffic nightmare, because they already have traffic issues of Lester. What are you laughing about?
Andrew just emailed from Everett. He said, here in Everett, our morals are too strong to allow something as insidious as pot. We may have a school superintendent accused of stealing air conditioners from the special ed department, a mayor facing sexual assault allegations, building a casino for a company implicated in more sexual misconduct. But in no way are we going to let the devil's lettuce in our squeaky clean town.
That's a pretty great.
Thank you, Andrew.
Pretty great email. Let's go to the Cape where Sasha's on the phone. Sasha, welcome to the show. Hi.
Good afternoon. It's Dasha. But
oh, Dasha, I'm so sorry. Welcome.
That's quite all right. So the difference between, and once again, the hypocrisy and that fear of that old fear comes in, because we have a clinic of Gosnold. It's an opioid clinic that helps for the opioid overdose and whatnot. It's right across from my home.
Town is that? What town is it?
It's Centerville.
Okay.
Centerville. Marjorie would know where.
I was just going to say.
Yep, I do.
It's right. It's right behind Lambert's.
Yes.
And besides the fact that they have a huge sign that they put up, and it's on all the time, and you know people's bedrooms sometimes are facing it, and not particularly want to have a big neon sign in your at 4 o'clock in the morning still lit up, but also the marijuana smokers, what do they leave behind? Pleasant smell? Maybe some wrappers from candies or chips? The people from the Gosnold leave needles behind.
Dasha, I don't know enough about Gosnold. I've heard good things about their success record is all I know, but I don't know enough about how they keep things down there in Seattle. Maybe I should ask my sister. That's where she lives.
But thank you, Dasha, for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Let's try to squeeze one or two more in, Marjorie.
Do we already go to Bruce in Worcester? Let's go to
not.
Bruce in Worcester.
Hello, Bruce.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
And I'm all for it. By the way, I'm in a suburb of Worcester. I can't mention the specifics because somebody might know who I'm talking about. But about a year or two ago, I got the free copy of... I think I give these out about once a year. Free copy of my local area newspaper, And there, buried on page about 11, was a story that a guy who was my personal plumber, he was busted along with his two parents for running a giant pot growing in distribution ring. I guess he figured along. He's a great plumber, by the way. I guess he figured along with the plumber business to get some synergy going on there. But my point is that this was a big thing in the local economy. And so why aren't we, as taxpayers, I feel like I was being deprived of that taxpayer revenue for, say, the potholes that my town is not filling on my streets. They're horrific.
Yeah.
So well, I would have to say it's almost, I think it was almost governmental malpractice, frankly. If you're a town that's struggling and this is legal and you have an opportunity to set reasonable restrictions to ensure a whole variety of things bad that don't happen in your community, if you need the money, and it's basically lying out there for the taking. Again, 3%, up to a 3% local tax can be assessed in addition to the statewide, whatever the statewide is, I think it's 17%. And plus, they're extracting, arguably illegally, but they're getting away with it, local cities and towns, additional things from these new pot shops. So, Bruce, I'm totally with you. That if you need money and there's a legal source and you do it responsibly, then go for it. Bruce, thanks for the call. And Marjorie and I have both been in other states in recreational marijuana things. And they're just, and by the way, the point you made before is really important. Unlike a liquor store, if you're or whatever it is,
or a gun store,
where you
as
can
Paul
go,
a
good point.
Out.
Where you can go if you're 14 with your parent or an adult or whatever
if you're
it is,
five.
You can't even get in the door of these places. You have to show your ID. So a 20 year old, an 18 year old, a 16 year old can't even go with their parent. So the safeguards are in place, and you know it's the law.
I stand with my previous statement. I think there is incredible ignorance about marijuana, like there's incredible ignorance about so many other things that people are vehemently against.
But it's not excusable ignorance. This is not obscure information.
It is inexcusable. But ask how many politicians who say they're pro-life about some of the little details about what happens during pregnancy.
I think you're right about that.
And they have no idea. It is amazing that they would vote against something that they know so little about. I think that's a fairly common, unfortunate thing for too many politicians. Anyway, we're going to talk to an ex-politician coming up. Andrea Gabral, she's going to be here with another edition of Law and Order. We'll ask her about Attorney General William Barr. Who is he? What's he about? Or is the Department of Justice wrong and feeling pretty good about him? Andrea Gabral joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on Boston Public Radio. Now that Trump has tapped William Barr to be his attorney general, the question is, whose attorney general will he be? Will he act as Trump's personal lawyer, or will his allegiance be to the rule of law? We'll ask Andrea Gabral about this and more. Then it's a tea party for 2,000. That's how many are expected to turn out at one of the largest reenactments of the Boston Tea Party ever. British Consul General Harry Cross joins us to talk about this and what the spirit of the American Revolution shares with the spirit of Brexit.
Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us to go over the latest education headlines, from President Trump's war on school lunches to a debate in Boston about bringing back the elected school committee. Then we continue the education conversation with author Tara Westover. In her memoir, she writes about how education was her only escape from an abusive childhood with survivalist Mormon parents. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
You were really holding that voice thing together
there. I sound pretty well.
Which might suggest to some that your complaints about no voice might have been scam-like. But
scam-like,
okay,
it's true.
Well, we're glad you're back.
3 days of shopping. It's
exactly.
Wonderful.
Here with us in Studio 3 for another edition of Law & Order is Andrea Gabral. Andrea is the former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety, and current CEO of Ascend, which ultimately will be a marijuana retail and something else. Yes, something else. What is the something else? I always forget.
What do you mean? What is the something?
It's not just a pot shop. Isn't there going to be more than that?
Well, in our corporate offices, we may very well end up doing a sort of a business incubator, but we are adult recreational use and medicinal use.
And we sort of feel in the spirit of full disclosure, because it was a story, you mentioned a story in the Globe a few weeks ago. You're at what stage of the process? Ascend is at what stage?
With regard to the city of Boston?
City, I'm sorry, yeah.
With regard to the city of Boston, we have a date before the Zoning Board of Appeal. They've given us a date before the Zoning Board of Appeal in 2019.
Okay. We're talking to Andrew
Cabral. Okay, so Andrew Cabral, you're an attorney, so is Jim. I'm dying to know what you think about the new nominee to be the Attorney General, this William Barr character. Some people say he's fine. He has said some odd things, but he does seem to be an improvement over the acting Attorney General, Mr. Whitaker, the linebacker.
Well, first,
tight
I actually
end,
thought,
first of all, but that's
tight
okay.
End, I yeah, thought he was a linebacker.
Go ahead. Backer.
I confused him with Robert Barr, Bob Barr, who used to be in Congress and was, you know, beside myself.
Was he the anti-gay guy? Was
yes.
He the, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, God. I remember
And then
him.
Realized yeah. That there was Bill Barr. There are a couple of things here. I mean, you know, certainly from what's been written about him, it indicates that he understands the mission of the Department of Justice very, very well. And that he would be a defender of the Department of Justice against what is currently happening to it under the Trump administration. But that said, it is concerning that he has made statements about the Mueller investigation and his sort of skepticism about it. And I think that that deserves full exploration. The fact that he was spoken to be a potential defense attorney for Trump, who is defending against all of this, also definitely needs full exploration, because that I think that definitely indicates a possible level of bias. And then there needs to all of his decision making as the former AG under Bush needs to be vetted. Those decisions that were made need to be vetted. So people seem to be satisfied with him as a potential candidate in terms of his background and his experience, although I worry that the bar for that is so low now that it doesn't really matter. But he should get the same kind of vetting that anyone else in his position with that amount of experience with the DOJ should get.
I mean, one of the questions he's going to have to answer, which is amongst those that trouble me, is he has said on a number of occasions that he thinks the so-called Uranium One investigation of Hillary Clinton, which has already been done, from what I understand, and no charges brought, this whole thing about, you know, allowing the sale of uranium facilities here to a company that has deep Russian connections, was more worthy of investigation than
right.
The alleged Russian ties of Donald Trump. But the thing, I don't want to say it matters most, but it is at the top of the list of my concerns about any attorney general, should this, whoever, Barr or somebody else, be confirmed, is what he does with the Mueller investigation. It was Jared and me, because Marjorie was out. We had Bob Woodward, obviously, of Watergate fame, who's just written Fear on with us a couple of days ago. And I asked Bob about whether or not it was too late for Trump to fire Mueller, because we're so far down the line with these sentencing memos and the sentencing, the Flynns, the Mullers, the Cohens, the Manafort's. Here's what somebody with a little more expertise than I, Bob Woodward, had to say.
Look, he has the power. And when Nixon, 45 years ago, fired the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, he made two mistakes. He turned over tapes, and he had another prosecutor appointed, Leon Jaworski. I suspect if Trump fired Mueller, he would not turn over evidence, and he would not allow or permit the appointment of another special counsel.
So it basically saying, don't rule it out. I mean, it seems to me the train has left the station here. Again, I'm not hoping that the president interferes through his attorney general with the Mueller investigation, obviously. But with all these indictments and pleas and sentencing, isn't it too late for this to happen, or at least to have the kind of impact that Donald Trump had wanted to happen?
I agree with you that it's too late for it to happen. I don't think that the reality of that is something that affects Donald Trump's decision-making in any way, shape, or form. And the issue is whether or not Barr's respect for the Department of Justice and what his mission should be as Attorney General keeps him from going along with any attempts by Trump to do that. I think with each passing day, you know, it would be interesting to have sort of a Q&A with him about how he sees his comments about the Uranium One versus the Mueller investigation, how he sees those today after all of these indictments and all of these guilty pleas and all of these sentences.
That's a good point. That all predated virtually right. everything publicly that Mueller or the Southern District of New York have
right.
done.
But and ahead. The sheer number of contacts yeah. between a presidential campaign and Russian operatives, unprecedented in the country's history.
But can you imagine a circumstance where even if Trump himself did not ask candidate Barr what are you going to do about Mueller? It's impossible to believe that his counsel or whoever his go-between was prior to the announcement of the nomination of Barr had not felt him out
yes.
on the Mueller investigation, right? And if his answer was, I believe in the rule of law, I believe that that Mueller is entitled to finish his investigation unhindered, I can't imagine him being the candidate of the president. Can you or...
Well, he certainly has been picking people for high-level positions who have sometimes no other qualification other than being consonant with his belief in his own innocence. But he also is increasingly between a rock and a hard place. There's the desire to have someone with credibility and who is respected be a choice, so he is not criticized for those very for those other reasons that I just mentioned, balanced against... You know, extracting a explicit promise, which could come back to haunt him, a la Jim Comey.
So when he asked for his loyalty.
Yeah, when he asked for his loyalty. And then, and so doing the same thing with Barr, he may have known not to do that with someone like Barr and just hope to work him once he gets in.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
So, Andrea Cabral, I've been dying to ask you about what's going on out in Wisconsin and Michigan, where, as you know, in the lame duck session now, the GOP out there is trying to take away as much power as they possibly can from the Democratic governors that were...
And Attorney General.
And Attorney General, that's absolutely true, that were just elected. Is this politics as usual or is this a step too far?
I don't remember anything like this in the history of politics, anything as comprehensive as this. So, you know, to look at, it's bad enough when you just look directly at what's happening in Wisconsin and Michigan and the fact that the party that lost seats and positions in the last election is actively trying to neuter the branch of government where those seats were won. So essentially what you have, a legislative branch and executive branch, judicial branch, co-equal branches of government. You have one branch of government essentially saying, we are not co-equal. We are superior to you. We will take power away from the executive because we don't want Democrats to rule. That is far beyond politics. That is anti-democratic. I think it's unconstitutional, and I assume it will be challenged as such. But it is only one facet of this. The other facets of this are gerrymandering and voter suppression, and they
right.
are all three legs of a stool that are designed to completely eliminate the democracy part of the democratic process and to ensure one-party rule.
There's a piece in The Atlantic which touches on the three legs you mentioned, but they add a fourth, and it's immigration policy. And they put it all under the umbrella of the following. The whoever wrote it, and I'm sorry, what's the name?
Van Newkirk wrote The Atlantic
okay,
piece.
That's what I'm talking yeah. about. Yeah. What Van Newkirk says, he opens his piece with a quote from Reince Priebus, when I guess he was head of the Republican National Committee at the time, but he says in this white paper or whatever they put out, some paper to the Republican leadership, that by 2050 this can be a majority-minority country. And remember, he says that in 2008 and 2012, Barack Obama won 80% of the combined minority vote, as he puts it, in this country, meaning we are in real trouble. And so his thesis, Van's thesis, is this combination of anti-immigrant, so that those people, mostly of color, don't ultimately become citizens and vote for the Democrat, is the theory. The gerrymandering, which, by the way, Democrats have done in the past, too, but it's elevated to an art form now, I think. This this Wisconsin model of deprivation of power thing and suppression of voting is all part of a minority party, not minority as in race, but minority as in numbers strategy on the part of the Republican Party to maintain control even when the complexion
exactly.
of the country. And it makes total sense.
It makes complete sense. If people haven't read this piece by Van Newkirk in The Atlantic, please go and read it. because it's extraordinarily well written and it makes perfect sense. And it explains the last 30 years of the GOP with that one blip after the losses that they sustained in 2010? I forget when it was that they had the losses.
Obama lost seats in 2010. No, that was Bush.
It was after Bush, the second term of Bush. Okay. So 2006 or 2004, something like that. Yeah.
That's when they did this sort of, they were calling it an autopsy, a Republican autopsy on the party. And they had a clear way that they could go. And what was being advocated at the time was for them to become
a
bigger
Romney.
Tent.
That was Romney, wasn't it?
Romney Obama. To become a bigger tent and to embrace the fact that there was a changing demographic, but that's who we want in the party. And there has been a conscious, deliberate, relentless shift to the opposite. And it has all of these components in it, from immigration to voter suppression to gerrymandering to literally trying to steal the power from an entire branch of government on a state-by-state level.
Plus all these judges that are being put in place that are very, very conservative judges. I think when the court cases get to them, it's likely
that's
they will
the reason
rule.
For that's packing the court. Yeah. Because that way, the Voter Rights Act, which was gutted, never gets ahead of steam again, so you don't have to worry about that. And the challenges to things like gerrymandering and voter suppression get squelched in the district court or the appellate court. That's the reason for packing the courts. This is probably the most comprehensive strategy to cheat a democracy that we have seen launched by a single party.
But
in
it
the
only
history
counts
of the
as cheating when a court says it's cheating. And, you know, when I'm reading the story, it provides further backing for the thesis, which I've always believed in. Is whether you like it, whether one likes it or not, the Republicans know far better how to play politics and have for practically my whole lifetime.
A dirty politics.
But again, until it's declared, I'm not defending it at all. I'm just saying before it's declared unconstitutional, as Andrea thinks Wisconsin may be, and the gerrymandering, even extreme political gerrymandering, has still not been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. They play by a different set of rules
And the members of the party play by a different set of rules. It is incredible after all this that the Democrats are tearing their hair out over whether impeachment is a step too far and whether we're just, you know, antagonizing everybody by daring to bring up the I word. It's odd. The Democrats are expected to behave themselves and the Republicans misbehave and just play hardball and win.
Right. Well, because even though you think, Marjorie, and you were in the vast majority, we took calls on this yesterday, that Nancy Pelosi was a big winner in that disgraceful 17 minutes. And by the way, as I said, virtually everybody who called or wrote agreed with you. I didn't, but I'm clothing them in the minority. People hate conflict. And, you know, even if they intellectually, this is my explanation, I'm not defending the Democrats in the House, but even if you intellectually say, I think this president has committed impeachable offenses, whether it's the felonious direction of the payment of hush money, as the U.S. attorney in the Southern District is saying, or whether it's the emoluments clause, or whether you believe collusion has been proven or not, people, I think, are anti-chaos. And I think their fear is, you're shaking your head in one second.
I'm with you, Andrea.
So then why are the Democrats doing it? Just because they're worried they don't have the votes in the Senate, which they don't have?
Maybe I should ask, who do you mean when you say people?
I think the vast majority of Americans want the dysfunction to end. And I believe that the Democrats believe that using the I word, starting an impeachment proceeding, will be seen as a guarantee of two more years of grotesque dysfunction. By the way, I think I am totally with you too. If they believe that impeachable offenses have been committed, is their obligation to start proceedings. I'm just trying to explain what I think is their dancing around this issue, which all of them, with some exceptions, are doing.
But how do you then explain the past 2 years if people dislike conflict? This is a man who descended an escalator on the day that he launched his campaign and immediately began calling Mexicans rapists and criminals and stood at his inauguration and said, you know, talked about carnage and that it was going to stop. And I mean, he has been the king of chaos.
So how do you explain, if I'm wrong, and I could be, I'm theorizing, I don't know what it is, why aren't Democrats who are otherwise more than willing, as Pelosi was the other day, and as that Chuck Schumer was out in the hall, at least, or in the lawn, Why aren't they willing to say, listen, while we're still waiting for Mueller, we believe what we've heard already is impeachable, and on January whatever, we're going to start hearings.
Listen, we're all three on the same page. It's a mystery to all three of us as to why they're not doing it, but the theory that if Democrats believe that people just don't want the conflict or they're afraid of offending people, first of all, who is it that you're afraid of offending when you look at the backbone of the Democratic Party and how people voted and which groups of people are all for impeachment? If they're afraid of offending a group of people, it's really only one group of people. But number two, if that's what you're, if you truly are afraid of that, what is your evidence that people don't want this confrontation? What are you basing it
on? So do you have a thesis as to why
dancing? No, I understand the argument that at least the theory, because I'm not sure even now that this is why people really do vote, but the theory that people want to have their bread and butter issues addressed, health care and education and things like that. I think all of that is true. I just don't think that wanting those issues to be addressed is antithetical to also wanting to see a disaster of a president who endangers us every single day by his presence impeached. I don't think those two things
are
different.
There I disagree with you. Explain to me, if the Democrats in the House start impeachment proceedings, tell me what bread and butter issue Senate Republicans, and they control the Senate, what issue Senate Republicans are going to say while you're impeaching our hero, Donald Trump, or at least the guy we're scared to death of, or at least his tweets, let's work together on infrastructure and improve it. It's not going to happen. Everything comes to a halt.
Right. That's true. But at the end of the day, when there is an election, and there won't be an election during this impeachment phase, mm-hmm. when there is an election, I agree that people do want to hear what you're going to do for them on education and healthcare and infrastructure and things like that. What I'm saying is that I don't find it mutually exclusive that people can want to elect people who are going to deal with those issues.
Okay.
I don't find that mutually exclusive with also wanting a president who deserves to be impeached to be impeached.
But you could also argue that the Republicans who are either afraid or think Donald Trump is a hero of the president aren't going to deal on health care because the health care is going to involve some kind of revival of Obamacare. They're not going to deal on climate change because Donald Trump thinks it's a hoax. You know, maybe they're going to deal on infrastructure, maybe. But, I just see that it's just an interesting dynamic.
So you think nothing's going to happen anyway? Is that's your contention?
I don't know what's going to happen, but it's an interesting phenomenon in the United States of America. When you look at the polls, we just had a poll up here by 80% of Republicans. This is John King's show, which I briefly looked at. Want to build a wall in the Mexican border. Now, most Americans do not want to build a wall.
By the way, 65% of Republicans are willing to shut down the government to get funding for
that
wall.
But I don't think it's all Republicans. I think their party's shrinking.
It is shrinking.
That 80% is 80% of a much smaller number.
But they're out of touch on everything, on climate change, on guns, on health care, on education, on the wall, and all these sorts of things.
They elected a president, you know.
Elect a president because, luckily for him, we didn't know he was paying off a porn star that he has sex with within days of his wife giving birth. Not only her. Do you know there were like three or four women on that same weekend out of that Lake Tahoe thing? It was both the Playboy model and the porn star and a couple of other women. I mean, unbelievable.
Okay. I just automatically sort of shut down when anybody brings up Trump and anything sexual at all. But what you're saying also is the reason for all of the things that we were just talking about and goes to Van Newkirk's piece. This is a shrinking party. More and more people are leaving it. People are moving, leaving the party affiliation, becoming independents, becoming Democrats, whatever it is. Holding on to power by this ever-shrinking group of people just makes it very, very clear who all of these efforts are designed to benefit. Because it makes no sense to be out of step on climate change and guns.
Or taxes.
Taxes and everything else.
Or education.
Unless you are simultaneously doing things that ensure that no matter how out of touch you are, you will never relinquish power.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral. Before Andrea goes, I'm dying to hear her take on a decision by a federal court judge who, we should say in the spirit of full disclosure, is a friend of yours, Marjorie.
Well, you have to explain.
Patty Saras, who is the chief judge.
So why don't you handle this one, Jim?
Well, this is a question, a case that was brought about the issue of the constitutionality of secretly taping police and public officials. And interestingly, the plaintiffs in this case before her, one is from the left, and that's what you'd really expect. And I don't mean left in a pejorative way. I mean more liberal people who want to – it's not fair to call them left. Sort of pro Well, more left-leaning kind of people.
Pro-transparency.
Who and that the cops are going to be doing things right. that need to be monitored or else they're going to cross the line. And then it's the Veritas, whatever the hell that group is called.
James O'Keefe.
Yeah. Who sneaks into places. And so it's coming from a couple of different places. And Saris basically decided that the policies and the prosecutions that have been brought by Suffolk County DA, by the way, where you used to work when you were young and irresponsible, were unconstitutional. Can you explain this a little bit to us?
Well,
do you agree with it?
I do agree with her. And I think some of the evidence that came in indicated, I guess, that the Boston police were affirmatively training on this issue, were affirmatively training new recruits that they could not be videotaped. But the essence, I think fundamentally at the bottom of her decision is that sunlight is the best disinfectant for a lot of things. And
Oliver Wendell Holmes, for those who are not paying attention. But go ahead. Thank you. It is him, right?
I don't know.
Can you look that up to make sure I didn't just embarrass myself
I'm sure you're not wrong. You're never wrong about anything.
Ooh, how nice. You know what your boss used to say on the air as often as he had an opportunity? That would be Deval Patrick.
Yeah.
Sometimes wrong, never in doubt. Thank you very much, Governor Patrick. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think at the end of the day, it was about probably a lot of things factored into her decision. Among them, the kinds of videos that we have seen of misconduct by mm-hmm. government officials that otherwise would not have come to light. And the idea that when you work in government and you represent government, particularly when you act under color of state law or municipal law, you are held to a higher standard. So it'll be interesting to see what the appeals court does with the decision and how they ultimately decide to parse it. But I think it was the fact that it was coming, as you said, there were plaintiffs that at least arguably represent both sides of the issue, both wanting
to do that.
Wanting to do that. I think it's an interesting decision. I actually do agree with her, though.
And she based
Jim,
it on the First Amendment. I was wrong?
We're both wrong.
What is it?
It's Louis Brandeis.
Oops. Oh, jeez.
You owe him a huge apology.
Yeah. It's okay. Brandeis University. It's local. Dreaded local.
Okay, can we try one other one?
Yeah.
I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it.
Stevens.
Potter Stewart.
Potter Stewart. Very good. That one, I'm 100%.
I'm not sure.
Right,
I just guessed.
No, I'm 90% sure.
Okay.
I'm
10% no,
sure
she. No, it is Potter Stewart. Stevens, I think, came like decades later.
Okay. Is that it? I guess so.
Yes.
Is that it? Am I done? Can I go now?
What do you mean you don't know? You're not the host in the Senate. We ask the questions and you answer them. Good to see you, Andrew Cabral.
Andrew Cabral,
thank
you very much. Andrew Cabral joins us every week for Law and Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety and current CEO of Ascend. Thank you, Andrea. Coming up, we're getting a jump start on the 240th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party with Harriet Cross, Her Majesty's Consul General to New England. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So for those of you who haven't been able to score tickets to Hamilton, you can catch the prequel this Sunday, and it's free. This year marks the 245th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, and the Boston Tea Party Museum is hosting one of the largest reenactments. It's from 6:30 to 8:30. Joining us to take stock of what this event meant for the UK, the United States, and the world is Harriet Cross. She is Her Majesty's Consul General to New England. She'll be participating in the festivities as a keynote speaker. Consul General, it's great to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And she's bearing gifts, she's by the way. Marjorie was so excited.
A teeny tiny Wedgwood cup for my little box of tea. And it's just a beautiful little Wedgwood cup.
You're one happy woman.
But so, Harriet, tell us, this sounds really fun.
Yes.
What is going to go on at this reenactment?
So it starts at the Old South Meeting House, where there'll be a kind of town hall meeting, where I guess people will say some very rude things about the English. And
can you
kind
handle
of,
that, by the way, or
I
no?
can handle can. It. I've okay. got a tough skin.
Okay.
So I will be there, but kind of in the background.
Understood.
I'm not going to dare make my presence known at the town hall meeting, because that's when they're kind of riling people up, you know, getting them ready. And then there's going to be like a march, like a parade across to the Tea Party ship. And there will be reenactors, there will be fife and drums, so there will be a lot of noise, there'll be a lot of colour, and I'll march along with them. And then we get to the Tea Party ship, and there'll be a little sort of stage, and there'll be some dignitaries up there, amongst which I will be present. And I'll say a few words, which is kind of weird, because obviously the British were not present at the at the event itself. And this is actually, it's 245 years to the day. They did this on December
16th.
The 16th,
right, yeah.
Yeah. Under the cover of darkness. Because I at first said, why aren't they doing this in the afternoon? And someone said, yeah, no, they needed darkness to do this.
Do we know what kind of tea? I should know this.
It's real tea.
Do we know? I know that. But do
I'm
we
kind
know
of
what?
I'm upset about that. That's a lot of tea.
I'm not talking about what they're doing. Well, I wanted to talk about that. Do we know what kind of tea was tossed in the harbor? Or were you...
It was the tea of the East India Company.
Right,
that much I do know. I guess it was tea. I suspect it was tea from China. So maybe Ceylon, Indian tea, Chinese tea, because they will have come from elsewhere in the British colonies.
So what are you tossing on Sunday? I hope this is environmentally friendly, by the way. Is
well,
it or
it's,
not?
You know what? It's tea leaves, so it's not tea bags. Ah, so that's the first thing to say, which makes it more environmentally friendly. But people have been encouraged to send in their tea. So people will know, oh, that's my tea that's gone in there. I sent it in. So it's the people of Boston's tea that's going in there, which is quite nice.
Where do we send tea? Your house? I mean, where do we send tea? Really?
Yeah, send tea to my house, please.
Now, where do we send it?
I think you send it to the Tea Party ship, the museum.
Museum?
Yeah.
So, you know,
Harriet, we should, just for people.
I think you're supposed to call her Consul General, by
no,
the way.
No, you're very welcome, General.
Call me Harry. I think we're friends.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry, my protocol.
You're going to call the Queen Liz if she came on our show? I don't think so.
No, I would have to. Wouldn't I have to talk backwards to Queen, you know, or like kneel down talking to the Queen? Anyway, just tell people who may have not studied their American history well enough, why was this moment so significant in the relationship between the colonies and the British?
Right. So I think this was the moment when a number of influential merchants, as much as anything, and business leaders, if you like, in Boston said, OK, this is too much. You are essentially what the British were asking for is that they had a monopoly on the importation and sale of tea. And the people of Boston couldn't control any of that trade themselves. And they were very frustrated by this. So when this big load of tea came in on three ships, I think, from the East India Company, they dressed up and threw it overboard and said, that's what we think of you and your tea and your monopoly over us. And 2 years later, the rest is history. But that was a really starting point for the resistance, I suppose you'd call it today.
Well, no taxation without representation kind of thing,
yeah.
Obviously, right? So do Brits learn about this the same way we learn about this or no?
You know, I'm slightly ashamed to say that they don't. I think it's one of those things where countries do well in history, they're very happy to teach their children about it. And when they don't, it kind of just slides into the background. So I didn't learn about this at school.
Wait, you didn't learn about it at all?
I literally did not learn about it at
school.
Well,
you know, in fairness, it's a much bigger deal to us than it is to Great Britain, which was,
but it was
the sun never set on the British Empire, right? They had a lot of stories about British empires and where the Brits were in charge of things. So I can see why it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, and let's face it, Jim, how much do we know about British history?
How much we know about any history
exactly.
in this country.
Exactly.
So, you know, Harriet Cross, I want to say this in the right way so I don't upset people who are doing this. I find people that engage in historical reenactments odd. I have to say, I have to be honest about this.
Have you been to the Plymouth Plantation?
No, I've been to a lot of the, and by the way, I'm sort of a hypocrite because I love watching them.
Yeah.
But I find it so strange that people like us, I think, contemporaries, normal people who have normal jobs, get dressed up and do all. Do you find it odd or no?
I don't. My husband would absolutely agree with you.
I
he gets
this.
Embarrassed by watching other people, even on a stage, do it. I love theatre. I love play acting. So it's fine for me. And what I think is really nice is that it engages children and also people who wouldn't normally get the chance to go to the theatre. It shows them living history and it gives them a taste of maybe a type of culture that they haven't engaged with yet. So I think that's really important. And that's why this, as I say, this is a free event. As soon as we leave the South Meeting House, the communities of Boston will be able to come and engage with this. And I think that's really important.
And you're expecting a couple thousand people.
Yeah.
And it is really important because, as we were saying half-jokingly before, we have learned in our 20 years on the air, 19 years on the air, the amount of history that we don't know about ourselves. I mean, is epic. It is frightening. And this is an opera. I mean, it's much more real and accessible and that sort of.
Yes.
So I think it's great, actually, that you're doing this.
No, I think it's. And the thing is, people can't really fit into the South Meeting. It's
yeah.
too small.
Yeah.
But they can. So you'll have the debate in there, the discussion, everybody getting riled up. And then where the public can participate is along the march and back down to the harbor. And they, where will the people, thousands of people be in relation to the boat?
I don't know exactly. I mean,
we call
they'll
it
be
ship, Marjorie.
Ship,
by
ship.
The way, we don't
Sorry.
Call it boat.
They'll be so they'll be lining the streets of the
okay.
parade, and then I think the way the ship is positioned, it's very visible, and there'll be a slightly heightened stage,
yeah.
so people will be able to stand on the bridge and around there. They won't actually have to be physically on the ship in order to see what's going on.
I think this is really cool.
I think it is too. We're talking to Harriet Cross, who's the Consul General from the UK to New England.
You know, one last thing about this: have I missed this? Have we done these before? And I just didn't know about it, because I don't recall this.
I've been here just over 2 years, and it hasn't happened in my time. I mean, they throw the tea over the side of that ship several times a week.
Yeah.
But in terms of a big celebration, I guess because it's 245, you know, it's a nice, clear, strong number. They're focusing on this celebration, and partly because it is a lead up to the events in 2020. Well, not that it's historically a lead up, but in terms of celebrations in Boston, there's a lot going on over the next 2 years. So in 2020, we'll be celebrating the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims landing in Plymouth, and so it's a moment to discover history, I think, and it's part of that. Process.
You ever seen The Rock, by the way?
I have seen
The
Rock.
It's like a pebble. I mean, is it not weird when you see it for the first time and you have this expectation that it's
yes.
very different? Doesn't mean it's not historically
significant. Well, you know, it's not that big either.
What?
The Liberty Bell.
I know it's not. Well, I'm a Philly boy, as you know, I've seen that a lot.
When I finally get down to Philadelphia to look at it, it's not that big. Okay.
So is there a little bit of a Tea Party in Brexit, would you not say?
To a certain extent, it's people wanting their voices heard.
Mm.
Yes, that's for sure.
You know, one of the things, without beating this to death, because we talk to Charlie Sennett about it every single Monday, and I think everybody's been following what's gone. Your prime minister has said she will not stand for re-election in 2022 in the last, I guess, 24 hours or something like that. The one thing I don't quite understand, I know you're in a position where you can't take positions, but just an explainer for me, why is there such resistance to another referendum on this thing, when it seems, at least from what we read on this side of the Atlantic, that sentiments have changed? Why is there such a resistance?
I think primarily it's because it sort of undermines referenda overall. If you say to people, we are going to give you a choice in a referendum and you decide which way we go, and then when it becomes difficult, mm-hmm. you say, you know what, let's try and get you to change your minds. I think that's why, and that's why people talk about it being undermining the people's voice by asking them again. We didn't like the way you chose the first time round. Have another go.
Who is your boss, the Prime Minister or the Queen? Who do you? I mean, I know you don't directly report, but who? What's the line?
That's a really difficult question to answer, because the answer is really a bit of both. Because I'm the Foreign Office diplomats are appointed by the Queen,
uh-huh.
and so she has sort of given me my role here in Boston, and that's I've got this beautiful scroll that explains that. But in my day-to-day work, I am here to represent the government of the United Kingdom. And although the Queen is officially our head of state, it's the Prime Minister who runs the show.
Do you watch all the movies and all the TV shows and all the stuff, which Marjorie, I like yes. a lot. Marjorie is obsessed with.
Well,
do
that's
you watch
one
them?
Of the things we debate a lot with Rebecca Eaton, who
from Masterpiece,
and Abby,
right.
and Masterpiece, all the other great Masterpiece theaters, is why the American fixation with
the
all
Brits.
Things British. I mean, I definitely have it. But one thing before we get to that and the royals, which we want to talk about in a second. You know, I don't know anything about British politics. I understand a little bit about Brexit. But I got to say, I admire the moxie of Theresa May. I mean, she was right in there in the belly of the beast.
That's the rule, though. They
got to
show up. What's that thing called where the Prime Minister goes into the House of Commons and gets screamed at?
Oh, PM's questions. Yeah.
PM's questions. I love that.
But also that she's basically said, I'm going to stay through the end of this, and then I'm getting out of here. And there's no good political happy ending for Brexit, I don't think. And she's just willing, you know, for crown and country to take on that mantle. I find her a very admirable leader.
Can you imagine? I don't know if you and I had this discussion before I had with Jared. Can you imagine if Donald Trump had to go into the House of Representatives?
No.
Is it once a week that the Prime
yes.
Minister does this? Right. And it was the president's questions once a week. He had to stand up there on the podium and the Democrats could yell at him for a couple hours. That would really change this
also,
democracy in a big way.
To be willing to go out on Brexit. I mean, that's not an easy place to exit, is it?
No
pun intended.
Well, actually,
Brexit,
pun is intended.
Exit.
So let's get back
to the royals. So let me ask you this question that I asked Rebecca Eaton. Of course, she's an American. She's not British. But have you ever thought about that? We are kind of obsessed over here with all the great British movies. And there's the new one now about Queen Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots. And the other one about Queen Anne and you know, Downton Abbey.
Oh,
and,
yeah. The Queen Anne one is great. I watched that last weekend. It's called The Favourites.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Did you love it?
Yes. And do you know what? The main actress, Olivia Colman, she's wonderful. She's about to play the Queen in The Crown. She's taking over. But you get the chance to see her as Queen Anne. She's
well, we're
wonderful.
Also obsessed with that. I was obsessed with that. Victoria, the whole series. I think that was Masterpiece as well, the Victoria series.
Forget
I mean,
this. Let's transfixed. Talk about Olivia Colman for like four or five hours. Is she, by the way, Broadchurch, we've talked about one of the best ever miniseries ever. Is it Night Manager that she's into?
Laurie. Yeah.
She is maybe the best. I've said this without you present, by the way. Maybe the best actress on the planet.
Yeah.
Is she as huge there as she's becoming?
She is,
here?
Yeah. Everybody absolutely respects her talent. And you know what? The other thing that I love is that she is a woman who looks her age. She doesn't have to. She's not artificially trying to look like she's a woman of, you know, in her mid-30s. She's a woman in her 40s who absolutely owns it. And I love that.
Well, except great. I want to say, I felt that way too, and I sort of feel that way. But when you see her in, for example, Broadchurch, which is literally one of the best shows,
I've
recently
watched season one and half of season two.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. You were late to the fair, but it's great. She's a little heavier. And when I looked at photos of her, because I was interested to see what she had played in her life, because I had never heard of her before. Yeah. Maybe Nightmare. I don't know which came first. She's a lot thinner in real life. So the sense I get, maybe, is a la Robert De Niro and what's the name of when he played Jake LaMotta and gained 45 pounds?
Raging Bull.
Raging Bull. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's not as dramatic as that. I almost got the sense that she may have intentionally gained a little weight to sort of play the wonderful part of this British cop.
Or maybe she was padded.
Sort of
I think you're right. I think she kind of lives for her craft. And if you go and watch her in this film, The Favourite, she is a woman without vanity. You know, that an actress can expose herself like that to such an ugly part, really. But there are moments when she looks absolutely radiant, nevertheless, even playing this very difficult woman.
But why do you think Americans, is it British nostalgia? Is it that we, you know, so many people came here from Great Britain, the Pilgrims, etc.? I mean, what is it?
I think it's partly the longevity of the line of the royal family. Now, we did kind of quite literally chop and change some of those members of the royal family. But if you go back to, you know, 1066, you know, we've had kings and queens along a line, one way or another, right through to the modern day. And their lives, to a certain extent, are behind closed doors, again, to a certain extent, which is a little bit different to the way Hollywood functions in the US.
That's
true. I think that's quite intriguing as well. And so when shows like Victoria or The Crown give you a glimpse behind those walls, you're fascinated.
So if we're fascinated with Brits, which we clearly are, and by the way, I'm late coming to that. I have to say Marjorie has been obsessed since I met her, and I'm becoming – I think actually last time we talked to you, I was talking about how I'm really not into it. I am a total convert now, I should say, in the best, I guess, sense of the word. But flipping the thing and how much the Brits are interested in us – are the Brits as obsessed with Donald Trump as we are? It's all we talk about. It's all we have on television 24 hours. Every issue has a Trumpian slant. And we know the Brits and polls are not exactly crazy about our president, nor are the Americans crazy about our president. What's the? Is there an obsession with Donald Trump over there?
I wouldn't call it an obsession. I think we always need to understand and watch what's happening with a U.S. president because they're a global leader.
Yeah, you know, but this is a whole different kettle of fish, is it not, with Donald Trump?
I think the media certainly focus on Donald Trump more than any other president, and that's the same in the UK as it is in the
US. I wish you could
see the
smile on Harriet Cross's face as she's answering that question.
So here's the thing I've always wondered about royal watching. You know, Diana came along and changed everything because let's face it, Prince Charles wasn't that exciting and his sister wasn't that exciting. So she changed everything 30 years ago, died tragically. Now you have this whole new generation, Meghan Markle and Kate Middleton. And again, I mean, doesn't that do wonders for British tourism, for selling newspapers? I mean, the fascination with these two young, beautiful women that are, one's going to be the queen and the other one's, I guess, what's she, the Duchess of
Sussex.
Sussex, thank you very much. The Duchess of Sussex. You know, it's good for the economy in a way, isn't it?
It is, I agree. And I think that is an important role that the royal family play, as well as the role in our kind of constitutional life. But I think we need to be a bit careful with that and not to treat them as tourist attractions, because I think then you get into the problem of newspapers wanting to generate stories about these people that are maybe a little bit fabricated sometimes.
Well, wait a second. Let's talk about fabrication. I want you to know, I'm on Twitter this morning. It has nothing to do with you coming in. I was just reading Twitter. And there is a whole line of stories, pro and con, Meghan Markle, for cradling her baby bump. I've never even heard the expression before, but there are many photographs of her with her hand, one hand atop her baby bump, one hand beneath it. And some are suggesting it's just, you know, vanity, that she's trying to, you know, play up or something. The fact that she's obviously having a kid, as we all know. Others are saying it's a totally natural thing. Where do you fall in this critical issue, Consul General? Are you pro-cradling or are you anti-cradling?
I am.
And we want a straight answer, too, here, please.
I am anti picking away at how a woman holds herself, because I think it's unnecessary.
Were you on this, Margaret?
I think she's afraid it's going to fall out, and she wants to be sure that nothing happens. I mean, you see this a lot. I think it's fine.
Can you imagine living like this? I guess American celebrities are in some ways where everywhere they go, everything. It is so intense and insane and ridiculous and intrusive. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I mean, I think you...
Well, you're probably into it, actually. You're probably part of the problem.
Well, I think you know. I think you have your head on and what you're going to get into. And that's why I feel that these women were older. They were much more sophisticated. I always felt very sorry for Princess Diana because I think she was so young when she married Prince Charles. I don't think she realized what this was going to mean to her. I remember those pictures of her when she was teaching at that little nursery school.
Yes.
And then to go from there to this nonstop paparazzi. And, of course, the paparazzi played a role in her death. So I think these women you can have more fun with because
I think
tougher.
You're right that the new generation made a clear choice at a more mature age to join that family.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay,
and I love the wedding, and we all watched it. Even you liked the wedding.
I even got up early. I know it's pathetic. I mean, I can't even believe I'm admitting it. So before you go, let's do bookends here. Tell people how they find out about, participate in, whatever it is, this Boston Tea Party reenactment Sunday night, 6:30, 8:30. What do they do?
Okay, so first thing is to watch the British Twitter feed, UK in Boston, because we've always got good stuff coming up on that Twitter feed. And then look at the Tea Party Museum and Ship, because that's where you'll get the information. It's all there online. Google Tea Party Ship and you'll find
it. Is your cat still around?
Absolutely.
Does your cat not have a Twitter account?
He does. Catsul_general. Yes.
I forgot about that, and then I just realized we've discussed that in the past.
And by the way,
I follow him, by the way.
Okay. People who haven't been, the Tea Party Museum is fairly new, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is, actually. Yeah.
It's absolutely gorgeous. So if you haven't seen it, it's worth checking it out. Thank you so much.
Great to see you again, by the way. Thanks so much for coming by.
Being such a good sport, and thank you for my Wedgwood mini cup. I absolutely love it.
I got gifts, too, by the way.
It's Her Majesty's Consul General to New England. She will be a keynote speaker at a celebration hosted by the Boston Tea Party Museum, home to one of the largest Tea Party reenactments ever. It's this Sunday, 6:30 to 8:30. If you want to find out more about, go to the Twitter. What was the Twitter feed again?
UK in Boston.
UK in Boston, or also BostonTeaPartyShip.com. Harry Cross, thank you very much. Coming up, is it time for Boston to bring back an elected school committee? Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us for that and more. This is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest education headlines is Paul Revel. Paul's a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab, and he's also, of course, the former Secretary of Education for the Commonwealth. Hello, Paul Revel.
Good to be here, Jim and Marjorie.
Good to see you, Paul Revel. So Lara Basilton has got is got a piece in the New York Times basically saying she agrees with the much maligned Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, about fixing investigations into college claims of sexual assault. She's not the only woman right. that's a feminist that's taken this position. And she makes some great points.
Yep, she does.
So tell us what she argues and what you think.
Well, this is, you know, for listeners, this is sort of one of these pendulum arguments that we have in the world of education where the Obama administration, feeling that colleges and universities weren't taking sexual assault seriously enough, strengthened regulations, in the view of some people, over-strengthened them, you know, in favor of the victims, but not allowing sufficient rights for accusers. Now, this administration has come in and said that it feels it needs to strengthen protections for those who are accused so that they have due process and representation. And this argument that you allude to that was an editorial in the New York Times where somebody said, well, I'm a Democrat, I'm a feminist, but I support these changes, which a lot of people of that description have opposed. And she introduces the issue of race and the idea that a disproportionate number of accusations of racial assault on campuses are targeted toward people of color. And that there is a due process, there are legitimate due process concerns when somebody's entire life can be ruined by being expelled from an institution for, you know, being involved somehow in sexual assault. And they, before that happens to an individual, they ought to have the right to question the accuser. They ought to have the right to representation. They ought to have the right to, you know, a process that involves more than just a single fact finder. And so I think the administration here is trying to strike a balance. It probably goes a little bit over in the opposite direction.
That's what I think.
But they're trying to strike a balance.
But you know what is so odd to me about this whole thing is universities are not district attorneys. They're not prosecutors.
You think it should be reported directly
to
the police?
I absolutely think these crimes should be reported directly to the police, although other people will say, well, then people won't report it and they're too, you know, they don't want to get involved in the criminal justice system, which I get and stuff. But basically you're having people at a college adjudicating
legal
things,
and
which,
criminal matters in some
which
cases.
Which is, I don't know, something doesn't sit right.
And yet at the same time, institutions have a responsibility to protect their students and protect faculty and so forth. So, you know, when charges are leveled, for example, there's an interesting case now that that I'm sure you've probably seen where Harvard is looking into the case of an individual student there, John Doe, let's call him, who has been accused of raping somebody in another city out of state when school was out of session during the summer. And the police decided not to pursue those charges.
She had one more element. The survivor has nothing to do with Harvard.
And the survivor is not a student right. at Harvard. And yet somehow Harvard was prompted, we don't know by whom, to look into this. And Harvard has felt, well, we have a legitimate interest if he's possibly guilty of some of these kinds of things, or if this is a pattern in protecting other students on campus. So they've launched an investigation. This student has sued himself in trying to protect himself from such an investigation, saying this, first of all, he's been found not guilty by the
police. He's not been prosecuted.
He's not been prosecuted. Yeah, okay. Right. Okay, fair enough. He's not been prosecuted. And, you know, Harvard discontinued it for a little bit when these new regs came out and then started it up again. And their argument is, well, we don't know enough about him. If it was a faculty member we were hiring and we were going to bring in a faculty member and there have been charges leveled, even if he hadn't been prosecuted, we would want to look into it to just make sure this isn't part of a pattern and we aren't putting people at risk. So it does raise, you know, really sort of challenging questions about where the borders begin and end about, you know, what a university should look in terms of doing due diligence in protecting its students and faculty.
I have to say, I know most, I guess most people don't see this as a slam dunk. I do. I mean, my expectation when I send a kid to a college is that without violating the due process rights of other students, they're going to do everything they can to make sure they're not predators on the campus. And the fact that in another jurisdiction, a Harvard student, that a prosecutor determined there was not just cause or whatever the standard was in that jurisdiction to bring criminal charges doesn't mean that by a lower standard, it's not reasonable to think that he may have engaged in sexual misconduct. And I totally agree with the line you mentioned before that some at Harvard are saying, is if they're hiring Paul Revel, when you started there, if it turns out someone had suggested you committed sexual misconduct, even if you weren't criminally charged, I would hope if my student's going to be in your class that they vet you on that front before they allow you to teach
but
my daughter.
To me, that's this case with the Harvard kid off campus. But to me, the bigger issue, and I think Bazelon makes a great point, we know that the criminal justice system is totally biased against African-Americans, that they're charged more seriously, they're sentenced to jail more seriously. It makes perfect sense to me that a young black guy, black man on campus would be much more subject to racism in these procedures involved.
So there's less protection for the woman then, essentially.
This is such a tough issue because so many times, a lot of alcohol involved. People, you don't know. It's very difficult.
That's arguing that a lot of these charges are false. I mean, is that
I'm
what you're
arguing?
I'm not
saying a lot of charges are false, but I think, and I'm going to annoy a lot of women when I say this. But there has to be. The universities don't want to talk about how this culture. Well, maybe they do. You're over there. Mm-hmm. The binge drinking, the culture of excessive drinking is so linked.
No, I think universities are really concerned about those things. I think they have a limited number of tools, and I think in this case, there is an effort here to provide the students that you're talking about some additional protections. I mean, you're not arguing.
No, the students who are the alleged perpetrators. The other person
right.
is a student.
But that's where the bias comes
but
in.
But one of the tools that they are not dealing with is the fact that if you prohibit alcohol on campus, what you do is you force people to be doing jello shots in their closets because you can't drink openly on campus.
That's why the Amethyst Initiative,
exactly.
as
to
we
me,
know,
that is one of the biggest
of problems
here is that universities mm-hmm. have created this demented culture around liquor.
We should say, right. by the way, the Amethyst Initiative, which was started at Middlebury College and then scores, if not hundreds, of college presidents and provosts signed on, was an effort to lower the drinking age to 18. Wasn't it 18 or 19 or some such thing, right? Because
well,
they figured
yeah,
that binge
saying,
drinking
was
far
worse.
Because
they're in a bind on this.
They're in a bind on this. Yeah. So you could be like a normal person and go to a party and have a couple of beers and not be, as I said before, doing jello shots in the closet.
I mean, to sum up on that, the other cases, I think there are legitimate cause to be concerned about bias in these cases, which means, you know, that we should bend over backwards to make sure that there's due process and fair representation for people and improve the process and iron out any bias that's in there rather than abandon the process altogether.
Yeah, we should not abandon the process altogether. That's right. Mm-hmm. I think she's made some great points about the racism involved here. But let's move on and talk about a little bit of something else. Should we have an elected school
committee? It's a hell of an introduction.
Should we have an elected school committee in Boston? I wasn't here for Jim's
Jared and
arguments.
I had this. By the way, he held up your sign. Well, you know that not only do I support elected school committees, which Boston used to have but doesn't anymore, I support elected judges, which we should not discuss today.
Oh,
we'll get into a fist fight. No, I knew that wouldn't work out.
Really?
Okay, but what's your take? Boston used to have it. Was it under Ray Flynn? It was
changed under Ray Flynn. Yeah.
Okay, and there's some talk now about going back to the old days. Why and what's your position?
Incidentally, as I predicted, because of the fiasco relative to the selection of the new superintendent, you know, the mayor sort of single-handedly dismissing the existing superintendent, putting in place an interim, also seemingly single-handedly without any process or the school committee being involved, and then letting it linger for a long time where we didn't know if the existing interim was going to be a candidate or not. That wasn't dismissed until September. And I had predicted at the time, it's now come true, that there's going to be call for representation by the community because people felt cut out of that and they saw the school committee get cut out of it, and that's a problem. So now we have a rising concern that people aren't being representative, they don't feel like they're part of the process, and it naturally raises the question, should we go back to an elected committee? I think the arguments about the history of the elected committee, particularly in the city of Boston, are quite persuasive. When we had an elected committee, we had racial bias, we had huge deficits, we had tons of cronyism, and we had poor performance on the school district, and we had pretty much constant turnover in the superintendency. So how somebody can hearken back to that as the good old days is beyond me.
Jim.
Wait, you mean as opposed to now when we have constant turnover in the superintendency? Is that what you mean?
Well, Paisan was here for a good, 10 years? Chang lasted two.
Yeah, Paisan was here for 7 or 8 years.
Okay, it was close.
And Carol Johnson, 5 or 6 years, and then were interims, and then Tommy Chang was 3 years. So he was the shortest one. And I think that kind of stability, and it's a more representative board than it was when it was an elected board. It's more representative of the kids in the schools now than it was when it was an elected board.
So wait a second. Let me take that argument, and I know you and Marjorie completely agree on this, to the next level. I had 3 brand-new elected women of color to the House of Representatives on my show the other night, so we did a little research, which anybody can do, to find out, with Linda Dorsina Forey retiring, there's a grand total of 1 woman of color, Sonia Chang Diaz, who happens to be the education chair, in the state Senate. So in light of the fact that that is grossly unrepresentative, I would make the argument, based upon what the two of you are saying, democracy is surely not working, and we should have Charlie Baker appoint the state Senate, because then those 40 people are more likely to be representative of the communities than an almost all-white, with a couple of very few exceptions. I mean, it's the same problem you're describing, inequity.
I'm not arguing that that's the reason for doing it. I'm arguing if you compare and contrast the elected committee, its history, and its the outcomes on school committee with the appointed committee, the outcomes seem to be superior under the appointed committee, and that's just one indicator.
Okay, so let me ask you one more thing.
There's something about school committees. You're going to go to cover one of these meetings. It's unbelievable. Everybody's trying to get their brother-in-law, you know, a janitor's job and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of under the table dealings.
Okay.
I'm not talking about the Boston School Committee. I have not attended a meeting there in a long time, but in general, big trouble in those school committees.
I would argue, I don't have facts to back this up, but in this era, that shouldn't stop me, obviously. If there are Democratic elections, the likelihood is good that some people may actually know who the people who get put in place are. If you stop 50 people in the street who live in Boston right now and say, name the members, in fact, name one member of the Boston School Committee, which allegedly determines, I would argue, obviously the mayor more determines, but determines school policy for your young kidlet. Do you think anybody could name anybody?
I think you make a fair point there. On the other hand,
not accountability, right?
Well, no, accountability is to the mayor. Now that there's mayoral control, because this is really what it amounts to, an appointed committee puts the mayor in the driver's seat, and that was the purpose, because the voters could hold the mayor accountable for something that consumes the lion's share of the city's budget and the performance of the education system. So you could hold Mayor Menino accountable. You could hold Mayor Walsh accountable for what's happening in the schools.
Why are you smirking? We're having a discussion on policy, and because the former Secretary of Education agrees with you,
I'm thinking
it's smirk-worthy.
Famous member of the Boston School Committee of years past.
Who? Pixie Palladino. We discussed that. Callers called in about Pixie Palladino the other day. By the way, if you had a prediction.
It also, Jim, depends on how you elect these people. When you talk about elected, the devil's in the details. So if it's elected citywide, you're going to get people who've got the most money who can run citywide campaigns getting elected to school committee. Now, you could have some hybrid form of district and at large, or, you know, you could even have a committee that was partially elected. And
that was a hybrid. A caller suggested that the other day. How about that?
That would be certainly a political compromise if one were in the mood for a political
compromise.
What's going
to happen, do you think, realistically, or nothing, right?
This is a long, slow process to get this approved. So, I anticipate that this will be an issue for a few years to come, including in the mayoral campaign. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that those who are pushing for elected will get some traction one way or another.
We're talking to Paul Revel, who's the former Secretary of Education. He's now at Harvard. Not yet, anyway.
So we all know that we have a childhood obesity problem in the United States, and we know Michelle Obama was very big into helping children eat more healthily and talked about school lunches, made some changes under the Obama administration, school lunches. The Trump administration is trying to roll them back. But I read this story in the New York Times, and I wasn't sure how bad some of the things were. I mean, why is anybody giving kids non-fat milk in school? We all know that, don't we now, that whole milk is better for you than non-fat milk? And oh,
well,
my
more filling.
God.
If weight is an issue. But there, well, go ahead. You give us your two cents.
Well, I mean, I agree that I think some of the rollbacks here, although it seems in general to be part of a trend that anything Obama is bad, we need to roll it back.
Exactly.
Or anything, you know, and we see it on climate going in exactly the opposite direction. I mean, the Obama regulations, what Michelle Obama was trying to accomplish was to make school lunches healthy, to make kids healthier. And, you know, again, it's a bit like the topic we were talking about earlier. It may have gone a little bit too far in some of these regs. And so this is peeling them back. It's peeling them back in a way that the food industry, of course, very happy about it. And it makes it somewhat easier for districts to comply. I think this is a matter of degree, and the degrees here are fairly small in terms of what's been done. But the directionality of it, in other words, the idea that we're going to, you know, embrace the arguments by the food industry to roll back and simply give kids what tastes best or, you know, what's most appealing, even if it isn't healthy, that should be a cause for some worry.
The only good news is that they're not introducing one of Trump's taco bowls into these. But, you know, short of that, you know, maybe you're right, the direction thing. But this is hard. You know, as a former, I've said this only 1,000 times, as a kid who was fat for part of my childhood, there is nothing worse, there's nothing worse. There are a few things as bad, both psychologically and in terms of your actual physical health, being a fat kid. And by the way, if you're a fat kid, you're likely to be a fat adult, which has so many problems attendant to it. It's ridiculous. And any move in a direction for less healthy, higher calorie foods, maybe with the exception of milk, as you discussed a couple of minutes ago, is based on what we've learned about dairy products and things like that. Fine. You know, increasing sodium content, ridiculous.
Right.
Cutting, I think, in half whole grain mandate, mm-hmm. ridiculous. And by the way, the argument used by that stooge, if you'll excuse the expression, Sonny Perdue, who is, I mean, really is, of the Secretary of Agriculture, the argument he uses is that it's difficult to comply. But as you said a minute ago, if you listen to all the trade associations that represent the school districts around the country, they say, for the most part, they're having very little problem complying with a healthier mandate. 99%
compliance now. So
that's pretty high, don't you think?
That belies that particular argument. Yeah, I mean, I think it goes in the wrong direction. It's not catastrophic in terms of the level or the degree of change here, but it does go in completely the wrong direction.
Where are you on this, by the way? You don't like government getting involved in any of these kinds of things.
No, I think that that you should have these regulations because so many kids eat both breakfast and lunch at school.
Exactly.
And you want them to have healthy food. And I remember going up before they changed things in Brookline at a breakfast, and I couldn't believe that. Like, they were basically giving kids bowls of sugar for cereal. Mm-hmm. And I was stunned they changed it.
Right.
But years ago, they would give you...
Well, it's like the chocolate milk. Now chocolate milk's going to be okay under these regulations.
You know, before you go very quickly...
Yeah, I don't think you need chocolate milk.
Speaking of school lunches, you read this piece out of Cranston, Rhode Island. I don't know how deep this goes, where the school committee or the city has hired debt collectors to go after people that have not paid their lunch thing. I mean, on one hand, you say they're apparently $100,000 in the hole, and I guess they don't want to be $100,000 in the hole.
Right.
What's your...
They're trying to be fiscally responsible and go after money. On the other hand, it's part of a pattern of what's called, in the field, lunch shaming, you know, of putting undue pressure on kids whose parents, you know, it's not the kids, but it's the parents who are not responsible for fulfilling their financial obligations on lunch. And they do things like prevent kids from getting lunch in the worst case, or in the case of Cranston, they're not allowing them to buy any extra things or get any extra things that other kids get. Some of them get stamps on their hands. Some of them have to work to make up for lunch afterwards. You know, they're getting stigmatized by virtue of their inability to afford lunch or their family's unwillingness to pay for it. And it's just the wrong end of the stick. We've got to find another way to solve that problem.
Nice to see you, Paul Revel.
Thank you very much,
good
former
to be
Secretary
here,
of Education, Paul Revel. Appreciate it very much.
Before you thank him or say who he is or something, remember we were discussing with Andrew Cabral the whole issue of what's the reticence, the reluctance on the part of the Democrats to just embrace the I word? Mm-hmm. Just see a poll on your favorite show with our regular guest, John King.
Independent
support for it. Well, I didn't tell the listeners. Independent support for impeachment was 48% in September. It's now down to 36%. I'm not siding with these people. I'm just saying it's because they think it means even further chaos, which is causing the Democrats to be scared.
They might also think it would be nice to wait until the Mueller report
maybe
comes out so we know what he has.
It could be a strategic decision.
Maybe.
Exactly.
Let's not make a martyr.
Okay. See ya.
Paul Revel is a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Thank you very much, Paul Revel. Up next, we're going to continue the education conversation with Tara Westover, whose best-selling memoir, I think it's been on the bestseller list for like
months and months,
talks about what it took her for her to get an education. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Tara Westover, the author of Educated, a memoir. Even though she didn't enter a classroom until she was 17, you could say Westover's education started at a very early age. She was raised on an Idaho mountain by survivalist parents who had a deep mistrust of public education, among other things. How she managed to break out of her abusive family network to pursue a PhD in Cambridge and more is part of this incredible story. Tara, it's really great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I am going to fawn of you. One of the best books I've read in a long time, and I feel like I've been living with you in Idaho for like the last week or so. So tell people a little bit about the unusual family that you grew up with in Idaho.
Yeah, so I grew up on a mountain in Idaho. I was the youngest of seven children. And my dad was something of a kind of radical. So he didn't believe in a lot of the things that most people take for granted. Doctors and hospitals, anything to do with federal government, public education. So we were never put in school. I didn't have a birth certificate till I was 9. So I had this kind of extreme radical upbringing. Of course, I didn't really experience it that way. To me, I think that's part of being a kid, is that whatever family you have feels normal. And you don't, it's just, you've got the one life. You don't have any other lives. You just have the one. So it feels normal to you. And so when I was writing the book, I was trying to explain how something that to so many people would feel extreme to me was not extreme at all.
But a lot of the abuse is not something that, even if you grew up with it, both physical and emotional, is something that I'm guessing you consider to be just par for a family course, or did you?
I do think that that's what is difficult about abusive family systems, is that they are warping in that way where even if you know something's wrong, it feels normal, I think. I mean, I titled the book Educated. I wanted to write about education in a way that was more than just degrees and certificates, but all the different ways education changes your life. And for me, part of that was gaining that ability to step outside of the system I'd grown up in and say, what are the things here that are okay? What are the things here that maybe aren't quite okay? And what am I going to do about it?
You know, Tara, just since you mentioned education, just beginning, just one thing. Almost everything I've read about your book prior to reading the book describes you as homeschooled. Having read the book, you were no-schooled. I mean, isn't that a fair description of...
I was at home, and I was taught how to read. An older brother of mine taught me how to read. And my mother, I remember she taught me long division. I very much remember her teaching me long division. And I remember her teaching me fractions. You know, so you can cook with recipes, like half a cup. And then, I never wrote an essay. I never attended a lecture. I never had any kind of exam from my parents. So it wasn't school in any kind of traditional sense.
We're talking to Tara Westover. The book is Educated. You know, Your family was very Mormon in an extreme kind of way. Your father worried about the Illuminati, and he worried about this, as you said, the socialist doctors and stuff. But one of the things I think you did so well is, you know, I was getting really ticked off when you described some of these scenes, your brother Sean hitting you and beating you and putting your head in the toilet and stuff. And at your father, too, when he allowed you to work on these machines after they just sliced and diced one of your brothers, because usually fathers will protect their children. They won't throw them into the maw, as it were. But then you had great moments where your father was so thrilled to see you perform or, you know, and sing and so proud of you. And then when your brother would apologize, you created that, what people call the battered woman syndrome, really, how, you know, the abuse and then the softness and the apologies.
Well, I think people are complicated. And I think, I mean, the fact that people aren't all bad is part of what makes these relationships really compelling and really hard to walk away from. And I mean, it's going to sound weird to say, but I remember when I was 16, I watched a movie at my grandmother's house that depicted this really violent relationship. And I had a violent relationship at that moment with my brother. And I remember stopping and thinking to myself, I remember having this thought exactly, I wonder if my relationship with Sean is abusive. And I thought, no, it's not, because he's not like that person in that film I saw, you know, this kind of caricature wife beater wearing alcohol soaked man. He wasn't like that. And a lot of the time he was great. 95% of the time he was great. And then 5% of the time he was really not great. And I didn't have that. I didn't have that understanding or that representation in my head of the fact that often people are really complicated. And what's hard about those relationships isn't that they're, you know, it's that the love is real, the kindness is real, the apologies are often real. And you have to just make decisions about what is okay and what you're going to do about the fact that people have these deep, deep flaws. And
we'll get off the deep, deep flaws in a second and talk about your education. But one of the things that is, especially with this deeply religious family, that I did not understand was when your parents saw, like, your older brother, the scene, I don't know where it is in the book, but when the wife is thrown out in the 0-degree weather and she shows up begging at your door with her feet almost frozen, how did that fit into that incredibly powerful religious faith your parents seem to have?
It's a difficult thing because my parents were Mormon, but they nothing about the way we lived is really Mormon. I mean, everyone in my town was Mormon, and they went to the doctor, and they went to school, and they had birth certificates. So, I mean, the first line that I write in the book is, this is not a story about Mormonism, which a lot of people really push back on. And I would say Mormonism is a character in the book, but I don't – it's a character interacting with every other thing. And I think probably the dominant character is mental illness, which I think is how my father could care about the safety of his children and put them in so much danger, and how he could really love us and do things that were not really great for us. And – so I think religion is a part of that, but I don't see it as the driving force.
Okay.
And I don't think there's anything in Mormonism that would say it's okay to do that to your wife.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a Mormon belief.
How hard was it to write about those kinds of things, the kinds of things Marjorie was describing? The sadism is the only way I can describe it from having read it. How hard is that to – I mean, it's one thing to live it, but then to retell it. How hard is that?
I didn't find it that hard. I think I'd spent a lot of my life – I went through this process of estrangement from my parents and half my siblings. And in those years that I was going through that, and estrangement is a process. I don't know anybody who gets estranged on a day. It takes a long time and you come to terms with it. And I think I spent a lot of time thinking about the bad things and every bad thing everyone had done and trying to add up the tally. And if I could fix it all in my head and hold it enough and it was all bad enough, then I could feel justified in the decision I'd made, which was to cut him out of my life. And I think for me, for a long time, I didn't really want to feel the loss of my family, so I convinced myself there was nothing good there, and it was just, it was all bad, and everything was terrible. So I really spent a lot of time dwelling with the negative memories, and I guess I feel like I became someone for a period who just didn't have any good memories. Like, I just became someone who had no good memories. It's not a very nice way to live, and what the book did, for me at least in part, was let me reclaim some of the good things. And those were actually harder to write about in a way, because if I was writing about something, you know, my mother was an herbalist and we would do herbs together, or we had this beautiful mountain we grew up on and it was really stunning in the springtime. And writing about those things, I would kind of have to admit to myself, there was real value here and there were things here that I loved that I've lost and I don't have them anymore and I'm sad about that. And I can't just tell myself that it didn't matter and that it didn't hurt me, because it did.
Why'd you protect their identity?
I just thought, in as much as I could give them any privacy, I mean, why not?
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you came from this environment where you were doing a lot of work in the junk shop and not really going to school and all that, to Brigham Young University. How did that happen?
When I was 16, I got it into my head that I really wanted to be a singer, and I had an older brother who'd been allowed to go to some school, because my dad got more extreme as he got older. So I had an older brother who'd gone to even some high school. And so then he had gone to college and came back and just said, you've got to get out of here. You need to go to school. And I wasn't really moved by that because I didn't know what school was. I'd never even been in a classroom. But then he said to me, they have music teachers there. Like, they have these voice teachers, so you should go there and learn how to sing. And I said, okay. So I started teaching myself algebra. You know, he had to go away to school again, so there's nobody there to teach me. So I just teach myself algebra and eventually kind of did well enough to scrape through the ACT and found my way into Brigham Young University. But, I mean, I didn't really know anything. I was just kind of there. And for a whole first kind of 2 years was really kind of faking it.
Speaking of not knowing anything, tell people about some of the things you didn't know about that you're asked about that were rather...
I'd never heard of the Holocaust before, and I raised my hand in one of my first classes and asked what it was, which I don't really recommend doing. I mean, a lot of the students, like, they just thought... I think they heard it as anti-Semitism. You know, they thought I was saying, what is this? And I meant it as, like, what is this? And
how'd it feel?
Not great. No, not great. And then I had to go to a computer lab after, and I looked it up, and that wasn't great either. You know, learning about something awful isn't great, and learning about how profoundly ignorant you are is also not great. And I think I started getting aware of, like, how much our world is really constructed for us by other people, and something like that could happen that everybody else knew about except for me, because I'd never been told about it, because I was just kept in this different world almost. And I had a similar feeling when I'd never heard of the civil rights movement. Yeah. I'd heard of slavery, but I'd never heard of the civil rights movement. And that was just such a strange experience, learning about that.
As strange as it is, you know, I was saying, when I'm reading that portion of your book, and I'm saying, I feel a physical thing in my body about the embarrassment you got to feel when you say, so, excuse me, what's the Holocaust? Is there all, when you know as little as you knew, and then all of a sudden everything comes rushing in, is there not a thrill that's part of it too, once you get, you know what I'm...
I think there's a lot of panic and confusion. I mean, it's because you can't even really process it. I mean, I remember when they were telling us the story of Rosa Parks, and he said that she had been arrested for taking a seat on a bus. And the only way that made sense to me, I just assumed that she had stolen the seat. Like, it was a really weird confusion of, like, to take a seat versus take the seat. And if you think about it, if you don't have a context for that, it makes so much more sense to think that we would arrest someone for malfeasance, for taking a seat, like stealing it, than it does to think there was ever a time in this country that you could actually get arrested for sitting in the wrong seat because you didn't look the way you were supposed to. I mean, it makes way more sense. I stand by my version.
We're talking to Tara Westover. Her latest is Educated, not her latest, her first and number one best-selling is Educated, a memoir.
And I must say, J.D. Vance, I think, in you knocked him out. You knocked this out of the park. Absolutely knocked this out of the park. But you didn't just go to BYU.
It's compared to Hillbilly Elegy a lot.
Hillbilly Elegy, that's why Marjorie mentioned
this. For those who don't know.
You didn't just go to BYU. You became like a superstar. I mean, you won these scholarships to Cambridge University. Hundreds of people applied. So having had no education, it sounded to me like you were doing a lot of reading.
Well, I had this. I didn't read a lot growing up, but I did. I guess I read in a weird way. I read a lot of 19th century Mormon lectures and speeches and journals because I was, you know, I was a good. My dad was quite extreme Mormon in the sense that most Mormons would be reading modern Mormon prophets,
right,
and we were reading the 19th century ones because we were more extreme. Yep. And so I grew up reading these really kind of difficult, dense texts with a strange syntax, and I think it was a kind of education. I mean,
yeah.
I didn't know what the Holocaust was, but I knew how to use a semicolon.
Yeah, okay. So that helped you in your ability to write these things, which knocked the socks off a lot of the professors that you encountered. You know, this is a terrible thing in the Me Too movement. When you describe it going in to see this professor and that professor, I kept waiting for the time he's going to leap across his desk.
No, they were all great. Even the ones that you – and this was a story that was really important for me to tell. I had a Mormon bishop at BYU who – in a lot of ways, a stereotype of a Mormon bishop, he was really anxious that I should get married at a young age because that's what you're supposed to do. And I wrote him that way, and he was that way. Like, I remember him as this I just think a lot of people on the left would look at him and say, oh, this sexist person, and look at how he just thinks women should be at home, whatever. And I'm not a kinder person I've ever met. And when I got sick and had a massive toothache and didn't have money to pay for it, he tried to give me money from the church. When I wouldn't take that, he tried to convince me to apply for government aid. When I would apply for that, he got out his own checkbook and was like, how much is this? Like, he wrote a check for $2,000 from his own bank account. And I just think people are complicated, and it doesn't matter if you're conservative, liberal, or for this policy or against this policy. The trick is to stop seeing people through this distorting prism of ideology and just try to start seeing people.
Well, just one thing. I mean, I feel like I'm cross-examining you, but the one thing I did – your mother is obviously a very talented woman. She did all these herbs, midwife, very successful in this business, I guess, in large part because your father was suffered the burns and people thought that she cured him. But I guess I wondered – she was not mentally ill, is at least my reading. He had the mental problems. So that's what I wondered, too, because, again, your instinct for the most part when you're a mother is to protect your children. And where was she coming from?
I think things get muddy. I think it can start out with an instinct to protect your kids because just status quo. I think my mother's instinct when I was little was just to keep my dad from getting angry. And so, not that he was violent, he never was violent, but, you know, he would get angry and he was difficult to deal with, and so she would placate him a lot. And I think for her that felt like a way of taking care of us, you know, kind of smoothing things over and making him happy, whether if he was getting really angry about something we were doing, she would calm him down. I think that felt like a strategy for her that was good for us because it kept the peace and made home life bearable. And then I think as we got older and as the problems became more severe, that line between kind of smoothing it over and keeping the peace and enabling like that, there wasn't so much of a line, I don't think, between those things as it got worse.
You know, Tara, we talk a lot on the show about apologies and forgiveness and those kinds of things. What do you forgive or hear, if anything? What do you forgive about?
I forgive all of it. I mean, I think forgiveness is something you do for yourself as much as for other people because it's not... I mean, in a way, I think if you're carrying around this kind of hatred and grudge with someone else, you're still carrying it. And you've bound yourself to that person by your hatred in as thorough a way as you could ever bind yourself to them by loving them. So I feel like you forgive people for yourself as part of moving on and saying, I'm not going to pretend like this didn't hurt me, but it didn't change me. In a bad way.
But it doesn't, well, it obviously changed you in...
It can change you in good ways and bad ways. But I mean, I tend to say, I say this. I think you can forgive people without reconciling with them. I don't think forgiveness is the same thing as reconciliation. Reconciliation, you know, I say I don't need my family to change for me to love them, but I do need them to change for me to have them in my life. And I don't have any control over whether they change. That's their own business. So I forgive them for myself, for them, because I love them. But I don't have them in my life because when they're in my life is worse.
Well, I also thought sometimes when you went back home, you were putting yourself in real danger because you didn't know when something would happen with your brother that was the toughest. But has your family, have they read the... They read the book?
Some of them have. Some of them haven't. I'm not entirely sure who. Yeah. There's some that I'm close to. I have a couple of brothers, and they read it, you know, when I was writing it and before it was published and all along.
You know, the other thing you really achieved was making me feel how difficult it is to lose your family, even though it was a difficult situation. I mean, that is... You tried.
Something I wanted to explain to people, and I'm not saying estrangement's right for everybody. It might not be, but I think... Just the fact that you miss someone doesn't necessarily mean that you've made the wrong decision. And for a lot of years, I thought I had made the wrong decision because I really missed them. And it took me a while to realize, oh, you can really love people and say goodbye to them, and you can miss them every day and be really glad that you never have to see them again. Like, these are conflicting emotions that are totally normal. And it doesn't mean that you made the wrong call. Just the way that loving someone or them being very kind to you doesn't change the fact that they are violent in a different moment. I mean, both of those things can be true.
But so, you must have had a really good therapist to get to understand all this. How do you,
better
maybe
than mine,
I need,
obviously.
Maybe give me the name of the therapist that I can go.
She's in England. I don't know if she can help.
In England. Oh, okay.
So can we talk about it? We talk about education a lot here, too. The book is obviously called Educated, a memoir. What is your, I'd say, triumph? What does that say about education? I mean, what's your
probably
statement?
Probably nothing.
You don't think it does?
I'm hesitant to sample size of one, you know. It makes me a little anxious to say, here, we can draw these crazy
So there's no education takeaway
no,
here?
No, I hope wouldn't say none. But I would say for a policy standpoint, I'm hesitant. What you probably can say, and what I wanted to say is, I think a lot of people, I think, have these experiences with education. It's a little bit like electricity, and you don't really notice how important it is to your life. And then as soon as the power goes out, you really notice it. And I think, you know, for my story, I had a really extreme experience with education. I never had any education. And then all of a sudden I had a ton and I got a PhD. And I wanted to show people that, you know, not an education as a way of making a living and getting degrees and moving to a nicer neighborhood and getting a bigger car. But education, it changes you. It makes you a different person. It gives you the ability to think for yourself and make decisions. And for me, those decisions were, these are the kind of family relationships. This is the standard I have for behavior for people who are going to be in my life. Like, that was part of what my education gave me. It gave me a lot of other things. And I wanted to write a story that was about education in this bigger, non-bureaucratic way.
So what's your father's conclusion that this proves, and I'm paraphrasing, you'll get it right, obviously, that this proves that our homeschooling is as good as that public education?
Yeah,
is that his line?
My dad didn't want me to go to Cambridge when I got the scholarship because he thought it was a socialist country. But he was also really proud because he said it really validated that the homeschool was really good.
Also, there were such tender moments with him. Like, I remember you called home one night when you were having difficulty or whatever, and you were in college, and I forget if you were at BYU or at Cambridge, but he said, you'll be fine or stick it out or, you know.
Yeah, and there were moments of real – my dad was a good person. He wanted me to be happy. He wanted me to be safe. Everything about my dad, you know, he really thought that the Illuminati had infiltrated the medical establishment and doctors were trying to kill you and all these things. So it sounds extreme. We worked in a junkyard. We got injured a lot. We were not taken to the hospital. For a lot of people, that sounds like a parent who just doesn't care about his kids. But if you really believe that the Illuminati is out to get your kids and they're going to do that at the doctor, denying them medical care, that's what love looks like. It's nuts, but that's what it is.
Boy, you're a much better person than I am. I'll tell you, that is for sure. You know, one of the things, there's a
local... thing is, you don't have to keep that in your life. Like, you get to make decisions about...
No, Jim, his father didn't buy him a lollipop in 1975.
Okay, fine, I still hold against that. Actually, there is some truth to that. It's a little bit different, but that is true. There's a local angle here, and I'm so glad you laughed about part of this, because the story about your father coming to Cambridge,
or
Harvard, is otherworldly. Can you give us like a minute of some of the experiences on the tea, the homeless guy, the walking in the communal shower? I mean, tell us a few.
Yeah, my dad had been burned pretty severely and he didn't really look. He was a bit disfigured, especially his right hand was really kind of a little bit claw-like. And he came to Harvard because I had confronted my parents about my brother being violent and they didn't really want to believe me. And they had decided that one way to avoid having to listen to me on this was that they were going to tell people, and I think they really believed that I was possessed. Mm-hmm. So they came to Harvard to offer me this blessing, where if they would give me a blessing, it'd be kind of like an exorcism. And then it was kind of a way, I think, for me to – I could have my family back. It was a way for me to deny everything I'd said, and we could all just reset and go back to the way we were, and it would be like I never said anything.
And they stayed in your dorm room.
And they stayed in my dorm room at Harvard.
For a week. Oh, my God. How big was your dorm room, please?
I would have emptied every bank, every penny I had to get them
a hotel.
Was
it like 6x8, 9x12?
Oh, it was just tiny. It was this little one room on Oxford Street. It was unbelievable.
But go ahead.
So they were in this. We were wandering around Cambridge, and we went into Boston. And my dad, of course, really likes the founding myths and all that. So, and you know, all these touristy spots, we were doing them, and Bunker Hill. We drove out and all this stuff. And then, of course, the end of this touristy week was this supposed exorcism.
But also, they're little moments. I mean, how much did he give to the homeless guy? $50?
Oh, I can't remember if it was 50 or 100, but it was a lot of money. but we don't, where I'm from, we don't really, if you're homeless, you just live with your family. Like, there's not like a homeless. So I think for my dad, he doesn't travel, he doesn't go into cities, so it was just bizarre having him here. Of course, he was wearing his, you know, NRA lifetime member jacket and his NRA hat, and then, of course, he had this kind of burned face. And
that's huge at Harvard, by the way. They love that there.
He was super conspicuous, yeah.
And how about when he walked to the communal shower in his towel?
He didn't have any shame whatsoever.
We're talking to Tara Westover, Educated. A memoir is obviously her number one selling book.
You know, one thing I was really curious about, too, you talked about how they were in your town. There were other people that were Mormons, and they maybe went to the doctor and went to school and did all these things. But it seemed like there was a community of people that you came from toward the end of the book where your parents were kind of the superstars. I mean, they managed to do really well in your mother's herbal business and expand the house. And she was thought of as basically a genius. And I wondered about that, were these 15 people that thought that this was normal, or was there 200 people, or
I think
who's out there in the Idaho
town?
That's what I want to know.
The town was 200 people, and I think a lot of people in the town, everyone knew my dad had really extreme views.
Yeah.
But I think that they thought he was pretty harmless. And the thing about my family and any family is you never know what's going on inside the house. So I think people assumed that we were getting a decent education. We could read really well. We could read better than the public school kids in church. If we weren't reading scriptures, we read fine. I don't think people realized that we weren't being educated. And my mother talked about homeschool conventions all the time, and there was a great show made of the homeschool. My dad was really proud of the homeschool. Just that there wasn't one was a slight problem. But I think for people on the outside, it seemed like there was a functioning homeschool.
How are you taking, before you go, this is huge. I mean, the other day I opened the Globe. Bill Gates has you as one of his five favorite books. You're one of Marjorie, and I'd say my favorite, not that it matters in the Bill Gates category. How are you taking this? No, I'm serious. How are you handling this? Is amazing.
I guess I would say I feel like my life maybe just stubbornly clings to the absurd. And I really felt like after Cambridge that all the weirdest things that could possibly happen to me had happened, and that was it.
And they have not.
No, and then Barack Obama read the book, and then Bill Gates read, and it just starts to feel kind of a little bit unreal. Yeah, a little bit. And I've had a life of kind of unreal things, and this feels really unreal.
Well, the book, Obama and Gates are both right.
That's right.
Spectacular.
And you and me,
really
Jim.
Great.
So there you go. We'll add that very
Make
impressive
you're
Ray list.
After Obama.
That's
Marjorie.
Right. Well, anyway, thank you very much for coming in. Congratulations.
She's on TV with me tonight, by the way, in Greater Boston.
Oh, I did
not know
that.
If you want to see her and hear her more, she's joining me as she
okay.
is. And we should thank our friend Linda Pizzuti, by the way, from The Globe, who was kind enough to help arrange this whole thing. Linda, thank
you. We absolutely should. I'm sorry. I'm going to miss you at her house tonight. Anyway, Tara Westover's book is Educated, a Memoir. Thank you very, 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 very much for coming in. Up next.
From the sublime to the ridiculous,
absolutely.
Right?
It's our annual debate. A real or fake Christmas tree?
Which you
Amazon
prefer, real
delivers
or fake?
Both.
I haven't looked into it in any intelligent way, but I'm going to go with real. Yeah. As long as people are planting them to replace the ones
that's
that you
right.
Exactly. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, listen to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We go from discussing one of the most important books of the year to Christmas trees. It's time for our annual philosophical journey with you as we examine the virtues and the failings of the real Christmas tree versus the fake Christmas tree. Are you all about supporting local tree farmers, or are you about exploiting the factory works of China? Do you like the smell of pine or the outgassing, or whatever it's called, of PVC? 877-301-8970. I am exactly where Tara Westover is. Not only am I for real trees, but how you dispose of that real tree, Marjorie. If it goes into a landfill, I just learned, there's tons of methane. It's an environmental disaster. If you recycle it, then you are perfectly fine. You may even have negative emissions, so it's a win-win kind of thing.
Have you been recycling in Cambridge?
Every year. My Christmas tree?
Yeah.
Absolutely, I do.
Who does that? The town?
The tree recycler, yes.
Oh, I thought they
no
just come and they grind them up.
No, I don't know what they do, but I think it's a good thing because it's Cambridge. 877-301-8970. We went a little over with Tara because we're both fawning over her work. So
I was fawning. I loved every second of it.
Time is a little short here. If you want to weigh in on this, this is one of our – we're beginning, I guess, a week and a half of our legendary Christmas discussions, but this one is going to be relatively abbreviated. So give us a buzz. Which do you prefer, fake or real? But you have to tell us why, not just your preference.
And Amazon is now delivering real,
I know,
real
it
trees.
Is sick. I mean, by the way, there's only so much you can get from this guy. Would you agree? I mean, enough is enough already.
It's so fun to go to the farmy place.
Or you go to my friend Boston
donuts.
Christmas Trees, my buddy Chris Gregory
yes,
on Harvard
can.
Street.
You can.
I would say that's a preferable alternative.
Okay.
You patronize local farmers. Several years I've gone out to the suburbs and cut down trees, as you know myself. I've done that. What's so funny about that? I've done that.
Jim hoisted it over his shoulder. He's out there with the axe.
Maybe I was.
Of course, at the Christmas Tree Farms, they have the guy that's there is one that cuts down the tree,
Jim. No, it's a saw. No, actually, I said no to the guy, as you call it, the guy who cuts down the tree.
Oh, it's a saw.
I said I will saw it down myself. Thank you very much. Back off is what I think of. I said
that's one of the great scenes in that movie, Chevy Chase, Christmas Vacation, when they go out to chop down the tree. I love that
movie.
By the
way, you know what the other thing is? And in a moment of real seriousness here, beyond the fact that the real tree – and by the way, do you know that 80% of the Christmas trees in this country – today are fake trees,
which I am stunned by.
But you know what one of the best parts is? How great is the smell of a real tree?
It's
and
great.
You can spray these damn fake trees. It's not the real thing.
Well, it's
it
dilemma,
smells like the little tree.
The balsams do smell better, but the Fraser firs tend to keep their needles longer. Although I don't know if that's true. I'm beginning to get suspicious.
Okay,
we've
got to take some calls, though, because we don't have much time. 877-301-8970. We may even continue this someday next week, but let's at least get it started now. Marjorie, where do you want to go?
James and Webster. What do you think, James?
Hello, James.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Like 50th time caller, first time getting through.
Whoa.
Oh,
we're so glad
good.
You
we're
did.
We're glad you did.
Better be good, James. What's up?
All right. So, by the way, I love you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Jared's cool, too.
We like Jared, too.
You did good this week.
Thank you. We'll tell him.
I have an alternative.
What's that?
For one reason, I don't like the real trees because I grew up in a house where the tree was still up there in April, and there was still the needles on the floor. You could never get them up.
Did we grow up together, James? Did you? But go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Okay, so what's your alternative?
My alternative is... I had roommates and stuff, so I didn't want any trees. But what I did was I just hung the lights up on the wall in the shape of a tree. But, you know, I would get intricate in the lights, but I would just hang them up on the wall. You know?
I love it.
Well, let me tell you, now I'm really glad you got through on your 50th. It's not my cup of tea, but it's a creative one, James. Call
us
again
soon. Thank you very much. It was a great call.
That is better than a fake tree, as far as I'm concerned. If you're not going to go the real route, for whatever reason James chose not to, then what do you think about that? Putting up. By the way, you keep your lights. Speaking of the tree was up till April, I drive by your house like to leave something off a couple of weeks ago. Your lights are still up from last Christmas.
Well, because I'm lazy. I hate to take them down and put them back up again. It's a big process. So I leave
them
up.
You have them on all year?
No, I just leave them up all year long.
Oh,
but the problem is that then you ruin some of the lights by doing that. I've discovered. James
sad.
In the car. Thank you for
Another
calling.
James. Hi.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Excellent. Thank you for calling. What's up?
So I'm a millennial, so you know we're always killing industries.
That's right.
We have an artificial tree, and I like it, one, because you buy it once and you hold on to it for a bunch of years.
Yeah.
And then it becomes kind of a central item in your house, almost like an ornament. You know, you bring out the tree that's been with you through these different times of your life.
Now, James, you are a bad millennial because
he's an aberrational
there's
millennial.
This whole article in Vox about how while millennials are, of course, killing all the industries, plus mayonnaise, raisins, diamonds, homeownership, and canned tuna, they have begun to buy
real trees.
Real trees.
Because of the environmental.
Millennials are doing wonderful things for the tree industry.
So why are you the outlier, James?
Well, I mean, my family, we all grew up with real trees and things like that. I will mention back to the other James, you know, high needle cleanup.
Yeah, that's true.
So we're in an apartment, you know, it's kind of tough to get it in and out.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, it's something that you bring out and you cherish, and it's kind of like that new thing. So, you know, maybe I can pass that on.
Yeah.
If, you know, my kids don't go the same way.
James, let me just tell you, because you sound like a nice guy, if you want to borrow my axe for a weekend and just go out there and chop one of those babies down, give me a buzz, okay?
Yeah, I'd be afraid my tree would smell moldy if I put it in the basement. You know, that fresh tree smell.
With all due respect, I have a few friends who have fake trees.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm still stunned that it's 80%. Do you ever see that? James said the beauty is you just bring it out year after year. they start looking a little ratty, and they lose their whatever they had at the beginning.
Well, I told you before we went on the air that I was over at Mahoney's, where I go a lot to get trees and plants and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And inside they have one of those fake trees with
all
their
ornaments. How do they
justify
that, by the way, at Mahoney's?
Well, because it's inside to put all the ornaments on. It's inside.
It's ridiculous.
And it was looking pretty good.
They could put a real tree up for a month inside Mahoney's. No fake trees at Boston Christmas trees.
Okay. I
can't believe you don't go to my friend's place for your Christmas tree. That's also nauseating.
Well, because
he's also a friend, you know him too.
But he doesn't have the. I know, but he doesn't have the poinsettias there. He doesn't have all the ornaments. He doesn't have the lights. He doesn't have the Christmas.
You know,
amaryllis.
He also doesn't have a fake tree sitting there. That's what he also doesn't have. Let's go to Patty and Linfield. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Having me.
Pleasure.
I call. What we do is, starting about 20 years ago, we go to the Topsfield Fair, and every year we buy about 4 or 5 seedlings.
Oh, my God.
And we plant them in our yard, and starting about 10 years ago, we started cutting them down.
Oh, my God. How big are they?
It takes about 10 years for them to grow to about 8 or 9 feet. There's different trees they sell every year, so it varies. This year we have a blue spruce, so it actually looks like a Christmas tree. Sometimes they look more like a Charlie Brown tree, but... it's fun.
But isn't there a piece, by the way, I know this will shock you, Patty, if you listen to the show. I've never planted seedlings and allowed them to grow into 9-inch trees. But doesn't it hurt to cut them down? I know there's a wonderful plus from it because you bring it inside and it's beautiful and it smells beautiful. But isn't it hard to cut down something you've grown from virtually nothing?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Because I feel like, you know, you decorate it. It's a nice way to end your life as a Christmas tree.
I think that's by the way, that may be the best we've heard in a long time, like planting seedlings and letting them grow. And that's great, Patty. Thank you so much for contributing to the discussion. What are you laughing about?
You know those little pine things that the taxi drivers have hanging down from there?
That's what that's what the fake trees smell like. I said that a minute ago.
That's what Paul says. That's what you do. You buy one of those pine things and stick it on your fake tree.
As an ornament.
It smells like a real tree. Now you have to get that spray. Spray
I've
the balsam
smelled the
stuff
smell. You actually think that smells real? You can't distinguish the real
smell?
Well,
it smells better than the pine thing that the taxi cab drivers have drivers.
I wasn't comparing it to that. I was comparing that to a real tree. Would you not say it doesn't come close to the smell of a real tree?
Balsam trees do smell the best, although I feel as though they don't last as long.
Doesn't it make you feel more festive, too? I mean, and you're a festive kind of gal. You are.
I'm a very
into trees. At Christmas time.
I'm a festive Christmaser. That's absolutely true.
Do you have any friends, by the way?
I have no friends.
No, I didn't. Can I finish a sentence? I didn't say, do you have any friends? Do you have any friends who have?
I wish I had friends.
Okay, fine. More. Do you have friends who have fake trees? I would doubt that.
I do not know anyone with.
So
a fake
who
tree.
Are these 80%?
I don't know. Troy in the car. Are you one with a fake tree?
Hi, Troy. Troy
is against fake trees.
Against them.
We love
good.
You, Troy. Why?
My daughter hates the smell. I went and picked up a tree, and I love working with wood. I inhale deeply when I pick my tree out, and she says, "What are you doing?" So I don't get it, but the house smells awesome right now. And then the other factor is if we can have an industry that actually encourages growing trees and replacing oxygen as we burn fossil fuels.
That's
all
right.
That, you know, Troy, that is perfect.
Now, Troy, did you go over the balsam? That's why it smells so good.
Oh, I don't care. I go for the cheap tree.
The cheap tree. Okay.
I'm all for green in the house, but I don't feel like paying for it.
Yeah, well, that's an honest man. Yeah. Thank you, Troy, for your contribution here.
I paid a lot of money for my...
How much was yours?
Fraser Fir.
How much was it?
I can't tell you now.
Tell me how much it was.
I'm not going to tell you.
Why don't you say... Tell me approximately.
Alan,
no, we're not moving ahead. You're not talking yet. How much
it was
are we
a lot.
Like what? $100?
Alan Marlboro.
$100 you spent for...
I did not say
well,
that.
You're not saying no,
said,
which means
Al
it's true.
Marlboro,
she spent more than $100. I'd say $140.
I'm ducking the question.
This is horrible.
Alan Marlboro.
Wouldn't happen at Boston Christmas trees. Alan Marlboro, next... On Boston, at wherever
he didn't
we
pay
are.
On the side?
No, he's a good friend of mine, and I love going there. At Boston Christmas, whatever. You're not at Boston Christmas Tree. You're Boston Public Radio. My apologies. Hi, Al.
How you doing?
Great.
We buy a live tree from a local charity. We volunteer to sell the trees for the local charity one night.
Oh.
Oh, we lost you. Are you back, Al?
He's gone. We didn't cut you off, or if we did, we didn't intend
to.
Yeah,
you know,
really
I'm really
sorry.
Upset about that. I don't know how to recycle my tree. I'll have to look into
Called Brookline or some such thing.
Yeah.
How much you pay for that tree again?
Greg, oops, he left too.
Boy, we're losing.
We're losing the calls. They're dropping like flies. Jillian from Chelmsford. Jillian. Hi, Jillian.
Sorry.
How are you?
Hi.
Hi.
So you're going to think I'm totally crazy, and we're a little nutty when it comes to
We'll things, decide that. Go ahead, Jillian.
We've always done, okay, when we started celebrating Christmas, when we got married, we actually went with a ficus tree because it's a fig tree, and we felt like symbolically for Christmas, it made more sense than an evergreen, which is like a Nordic tradition and nothing to do with Christ's birthday. And we wanted to try to keep Christmas, we're very Christian, and we wanted to keep Christmas a little bit more about Jesus, a little less about presents and all that stuff. So anyway, so my son, I thought would rebel against this, but he actually loves it, and guy's gotten very into it. But ficuses are very picky trees, and so it's been hard to grow it very big, and we make ornaments every year, and it's getting to be too much. So we actually bought a fake ficus. So we have a real ficus tree in one room.
So wait a second. What did you say our reaction to this was going to be? What did you say at the beginning of the call?
That I'm crazy.
Okay, thank you. You said it.
But you're having a good time, Jillian, so what the heck?
Right? I haven't even heard. Have you heard of that kind of tree?
Ficus? I've heard of ficus plant. I didn't
so
know
a ficus grows
tree.
Figs? Is that what you're saying, Jillian? I'm sorry for my lack of knowledge. Is that what
a
it is?
Yeah, a ficus is actually, when I looked it up, because we were going to try to get an almond tree.
Sure you
but
were.
There, you can't. You have to plant them outside.
Okay.
And so a ficus is actually a variant of a fig tree.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And a fig tree is very symbolic in the Bible, so we went with a fig tree.
Okay, well, to each his own, as
Jillian
they say.
Is having Jillian, a great holiday already, I can tell.
She can't decide. Jillian, thank you very very much.
Can we
That's not
one
a horrible compromise. I mean, it is a little odd, but it's not. We can squeeze in one more.
Peter really, Framingham.
30
Peter.
Seconds, Peter. Go.
Hey there. How you guys? Really quick.
Great.
Fake trees are the way to go. You set them up. They're ready in 5 minutes. Real trees, you cut them down. You put them in the water, and there's mold at the bottom. And remember this. Fake friends have real trees. Real friends have fake trees.
That is so deep. That
Peter,
is
that
so
was fantastic.
Deep. It is incredible.
I think
Peter,
you make
thank
a lot
you
of money with
call.
That motto. You should,
no, I like
you, should
that.
You know, put a patent on it.
Trademark. Patent,
trademark, whatever.
It is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Boy, Jim.
What?
It's a lot
you're
of talking.
Back.
A lot of talking.
That's
I didn't
what
realize.
Happens. You have a 3 hour show.
Days. A lot of talking is involved.
By the way, if you're losing your voice again, it appears.
I'm losing it a little bit. Yes,
that'd
I am.
That'd be horrible.
Okay, thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us 24/7 by way of our podcast and iTunes, or see us in person. We're going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. We're going to be joined by Callie Crossley and Emily Rooney, our Friday All-Stars, of course, on News Quiz 2. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murrs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. I haven't been able to ask you for days, what is on the award-winning Jim Browdy Show?
It's not starring. I'm the host of Greater Boston. It's not starring. I don't say that. You do. Now, first of all, you know who half of the show is Tara Westover. And she, not only is the book great, she is great.
She's
that was,
great.
That was, I really love that.
So you know who she is?
What?
Really smart. That's why she wrote
Boy,
that great book.
Boy, she's really talented, too.
Yeah.
Her first book, by the way.
I know.
So in any case, Tara will join me tonight. And you're going to love this half of the show. Larry Tribe from Harvard Law School is coming. And if you saw his op-ed the other day, unlike a lot of lawyers of his caliber, he says the Constitution does not protect a sitting president from getting indicted, despite what that Justice Department memo circulating around has to say. So Larry Tribe, Tara Westover, and a terrific package around, well, a terrific package by Stephanie Lydon tonight. You should watch it, too. And I'm going to also talk about the ineptitude of members of Congress when it comes to their tech abilities. That's all tonight.
Excellent. I'm Marjorie Egan.
Why are you laughing? What are you laughing
Nothing,
about?
Nothing, I just don't know. I'm laughing.
How'd it go
Jim?
For you, first day back?
It was,
it's like
it
riding
was,
a bicycle,
tough.
Isn't it?
It was tough. I'm exhausted.
It was tough for me, too. In any case, I'm Jim Browdy. I am thrilled she's back.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thank you very much
See
for
you
listening.
Later.
Please tune in tomorrow and have a great afternoon.
Bye.